everywhere I live.
RoboZone coming up. He's got a long way to go.
Retro Gaming Radio 2011. Keep it retro.
Hello, folks. Welcome to the August 2012 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. This is Shane R. Monroe, your host. Welcome to the program. Well, we have a great show put together this month for you, but first some basic housekeeping stuff before we get into the show. First of all, can you believe it? It has been 1 year since Retro Gaming Radio came back on the air. That's right. This is our 12th show. We restarted the show again in August 2011. This is our 12th episode, closing out this year of Retro Gaming Radio. Absolutely crazy. It seems like we just started doing the show again, and it's already been another year. So, absolutely fantastic. That means we need to start thinking about doing something special for this year's release of Retro Gaming Radio and the shows. Before we get on with that, though, there's still a couple of things left in the pipeline, isn't there? First off, that elusive Year 8 DVD-ROM, which, as many of you may or may not know, has entered final beta testing. I'm testing out a variety of different OSs, mainly XP, Vista, and Windows 7, 32-bit and 64-bit versions. Everything's looking pretty good, so I don't think it's going to be a big problem getting that out. I just need to secure my DVD insert and get those all packaged up, and we will get those out the door. One of the things that people have been asking for, actually for years now, is a 10-year commemorative edition of Retro Gaming Radio. That is, all 10 years of the classic shows. I've been kicking this around, and the fact that it's taken me 20 billion years to get the Year 8 disc out lets me know maybe I just don't have the drive to keep putting these big collections out. On the other hand, I want to give my fans what they want. So, recently there's been a huge rash of Kickstarter projects. Now, we've talked a little bit about Kickstarter in the past. Essentially, people pledge money behind a project, and if the predetermined amount of money is pledged, then Kickstarter is called funded. Everybody's donations get pulled out of their Amazon account, and the project is considered funded. Then the money is used to fulfill the product that you pledged for. Now, the interesting thing about this is the Kickstarter projects allow you to have levels of participation. Let's say you're just a fan of the show. You really don't care about the discs. You just want to throw me a five spot, right? You want to throw me $5, $10, whatever. So you could do that. You could go to the Kickstarter project and you could say, listen, I want to see Retro Gaming Radio continue. I don't really want the 10-year commemorative disc. So here's $10. Thanks for all the good times, right? And so when the project funded, the $10 would come out and it would go into the RGR fund. Now, a higher level, let's say $25 or $50 or $75, whatever the pledge numbers go up to, would represent a different level of commitment, right? As well as a different level of reward. So I have to come up with a number that is a satisfactory value for 10 years of Retro Gaming Radio. Essentially, you'd be getting all of the DVDs, all the way up through Year 8, plus all of the stuff that hasn't made any disc set yet. So technically speaking, it's more like 9 years of shows, but technically it's 10 years of Retro Gaming Radio. So that's a lot of content, right? That's a lot of product. So I have to come up with a number that makes sense. So everybody who donates that amount gets the disc for free, essentially. They've pre-ordered it, if you will. And of course, we could go higher than that, right? Let's say the number I pull out is $75. You donate the $75, you automatically get the disc sent to you, or the disc set, actually, because it can't be just one DVD, but you're going to get the whole deal sent to you. If you pledge $100, then you get the disc plus a personalized autograph, right? You can have me put whatever you want on it, and I'll sign it and send it out, et cetera, et cetera. You get the idea, right? So that's how the Kickstarter project works. And so I'm considering the concept of funding the Year 10 DVD that way. There's two reasons why I'm considering that. One, it lights a really big fire under my butt to get it done. That's a big thing. That's a huge commitment. And it's, you know, it's a sort of almost like a mini commercial endeavor, right? So I don't want that to tarnish my already poor name for getting the year eight out disc out so late. But my point is it definitely encourages me more to do the product. The other thing is this really changes the scope of how the year 10 disc could be put out. Now, right now, you know, we kind of have a garage scenario going on, right? I had a professional design the DVD inlays, you know, but I package them myself, I wrap them myself, I stick them through a Casio disc label printer, and I print the labels. It's a garage scenario. It's a garage store type thing. But, if I did a good Kickstarter project, I could have these commercially done. Now, I've already researched it. I'm not going to get away with a single disc release. Most duplicators will only do single layer discs, which means a maximum of 4.7 gigabytes per disc. Now, you're talking 8 years of shows plus all the bonus content. That ain't going to fit on one disc. I'm thinking more like 3 discs, possibly 4 discs. Maybe 3 if I crunch everything down. I don't know yet, but it's probably going to be 3 discs. So I contacted a disc mastering facility and said, listen, I want 300, if I ordered 300 pieces, which should be more than enough to fulfill the Kickstarter bid, 300 pieces, I want professionally done labels, inserts, I want professional cases, I want the discs in full color printing, I don't want any cheap crap. This would actually look like you went onto the shelf and bought it from a store. Look like a totally professional deal. What would that cost? Right? So it looks like for somewhere around $2,800, maybe a little less, I could have that done. Now that covers material and basically having a huge truck backed up to my house and dumping 300 discs on me. 300 fully ready to go package. I still have to buy the shipping. I still have to pay the postage. There's my time that I have to look at too. Obviously, if somehow I can make a couple of dollars to support the show, right? I got to pay my web host. I got to pay, I got to buy stuff for the show. You know, I don't accept people sending me free stuff. I tend to like to buy the stuff for the show that I review. Unless it's just simply out of line and I just can't afford it, then, you know, you want to bring one by the house, sure. But most of you know that the show is fairly out of pocket. So it'd be nice if I could make sure that there was a good incentive to keep this project front and center on my radar. So figuring all that out is part of the challenge of writing the Kickstarter project. So suffice to say, I don't even know if I'm going to do it yet, but I would love your feedback. I'd love your input. Send me an email. Let me know. Post on the forums. Post on Google+, whatever. Let me know what you think. We've already got a thread. I'm sure Alex J. Lopez has already forwarded it to you if you're watching it in the RGR Plus TV. If not, then definitely check out the links list for this episode on the RetroGamingRadio.com website. And it will give you a link to where we're discussing this and some prices and all that good stuff. So you can kind of follow along what we're up to. I'd like to see it happen. If that's not what my customers want, if that's what you, my listeners, would prefer to have a standard garage style release, then that's what we'll do. But I thought this Kickstarter offered a unique opportunity for me to do something different with it and really come up with a professional type product. So that's what I'm looking at for the year 10, ultimate super elite, decade edition or whatever it's going to be called. Lastly, I would like to open up a little challenge, a little contest here. Now, I'm not the greatest musician, and typically before the good friend of the show and the producer of the show, Brian Kidhype Smith, passed away, he was doing some of the great arcade mixes and intros for the show. However, I do not have his talent. I can put together something that's reasonably interesting for an intro, but obviously, musical skill is not my forte. So I would like to open up a contest. I don't know what kind of prize we're going to have other than the fact that your intro will be playing on Retro Gaming Radio every single month for the rest of the year. I would like to open up a contest to see who can produce the best retro gaming radio intro for the year 2013. Now, we'll start that as soon as we get enough submissions and we pick a winner. We'll go ahead and start that new intro right away because, as you know, our broadcast year goes from August to August. So, if you would like to get in on it, there will be information posted. We're going to put together an official link, official rules, maybe put together some collections of samples, right? You can take anything you want from the show. You can take anything classic gaming related. You guys know what the show's about. You guys know what I talk about. You can cut and paste my quotes. You can ask me for maybe some custom material, that sort of thing. So if you're interested, keep an eye out. I'm going to be posting some stuff. Follow us on Twitter, Retro Gaming Radio, minus the O at the end, because they wouldn't let us have one that long. Retro Gaming Radio has a Google Plus page. And, of course, you can always email me at ShaneRMonroe@RetroGamingRadio.com. If you submit something through BitsAndBytes@RetroGamingRadio.com, I'll get it as well. So if you're interested in doing that, let me know. And I will try to get some assets together so that you guys have something to work with. And I can't wait to see what you guys come up with. I know we have some very talented people in my listener base, and I would love to have a really nice sounding intro for the next year. All right. Let's see. So what do we got going here? Let's see. This month, we have a new editorial commentary, Games That Wouldn't Exist If Williams Were Apple, discussing a little bit about the Apple versus Samsung decision and how it could have affected classic gaming if Williams Electronics were Apple. We have an anniversary, speaking of Williams, of Robotron. Robotron celebrates its 30th anniversary this year, and I've got tons of information and stories to tell you about Robotron. So that's going to be our anniversary segment. I have another feature for you, the closing of Psygnosis. Yes, Psygnosis, the greatest game developer company on the Amiga, dare I say one of the greatest game developers of all time, is officially closed now, and we got a whole background story on that for you. Of course, the venerable Bits and Bytes. Two reviews, if you can believe it. One's on Droid Tower, which we talked a little bit about last month. This is Dark Tower, the board game, on your Android phone. Very cool. And another great hail back to classic video gaming, Deadly Dungeons, which is a Dungeon Master, Eye of the Beholder, Bard's Tale type of game, also available on your Android phone. And we're going to give you a review of that. All of this and so much more. Stay tuned to Retro Gaming Radio. This month's reader mail comes from Kevin from ComputerSpaceFan.com. Hi Shane, this is Kevin again from ComputerSpaceFan.com. I just wanted to ask how you manage to do so much in your day. Between recording all your shows, your karate, and being a father, when do you have time to do any gaming? Speaking of gaming, I loved your recent spotlight on the handheld games of the 70s and 80s. One item I always thought was cool, which you did not mention, was that the handheld called UFO Master by Bambino was used as background music in Blade Runner. I've attached the YouTube clip, and if you listen carefully to the song called Memories of Green on the soundtrack, you can hear the beeps and bloops of the handheld being played. This is not from the set. This is from the song itself. Evangelist intended to use the handheld as a way to add futuristic sound to his score. Keep up the great work, Kevin. Well, if you are watching on the Retro Gaming Radio Plus TV, you're probably already seeing that available to you in our video play window. Of course, you'll have to turn it up so you can hear it. Otherwise, we will provide links for you so that you can compare the original gameplay and the Blade Runner audio track. It's actually interesting, but I've seen Blade Runner a gajillion times, and I would have never made that connection. So thank you, Kevin, for sending that in. In answer to your question, how do you manage to do so much in your day? The simple truth is I don't sleep. I typically go to bed at 11 p.m. and I get up around 5:30 a.m. So there's not a lot of sleep going on. I also have a family who exists in the very early morning hours, so they go to bed very early, especially during the school year. My family ends up going to bed at 7 o'clock, 7:30 at night, and I go to bed at 11, which leaves me quite a bit of time to put together the show and to do other stuff. But sometimes it is challenging, and I tend to record the show towards the end of the month when I really should be being a good host and recording the show throughout the month. But as you know, time gets in the way. So thank you, Kevin, for your reader email. Hey, if you want to hear your letter read on the air, just send me an email, shanearmonroe@retrogamingradio.com, or you could send it in through the bits and bytes at retrogamingradio.com. I check them both, and we could be reading your message here on the air. This month's editorial commentary is directly inspired by the recent courtroom warfare between Apple and Samsung. Now, Apple claims that Samsung violated a ton of their patents. Such patents included things like rectangles with rounded corners and a phone icon that was green with a handset in it. These are the sort of things that Apple got away with patenting and actually are going to be awarded up to $1 billion from Samsung. And I was following these proceedings and the whole fact that they threw out previous art and all that good stuff. And it occurred to me, what if one of our early predecessors in the video gaming industry, Williams Electronics, what if they were Apple? What if they chose to be patent trolls like Apple and they pursued everybody that knocked off something that they did or borrowed from their concepts, such as Robotron? Robotron is arguably the first twin-stick shooter. And if there's a game that has been ripped off more than Robotron, I'd like to see it. Modern games, classic games, not just dual stick controls, but the exact movement and independent firing directional controls as Robotron. Now let's say that Williams wanted to jump everybody's butt that used two sticks and or independent firing controls. What would that have meant? What sort of things would have happened thanks to patent trolling on Williams' part if they decided to take the Apple road? Well, let's talk about the games that we would be missing out on. We would be missing out on Black Widow. Now, I love Black Widow. I think Black Widow is a great game. It is a vector game, very similar to Robotron, except for you're a Black Widow spider and you're on this big, giant spider web. It's very cool. It's got unusual sound effects and the whole bit. It's a very cool game. That game, direct knockoff, Williams would have had a field day with them in court. No Black Widow. What about Cloak and Dagger? Atari wouldn't have been making Cloak and Dagger because it too featured independent movement and independent firing. There would be no Cloak and Dagger. Now, a lot of people didn't like Cloak and Dagger. I happen to think it was a fun game. What else would we not have seen? Krull. Krull we would not have seen. Krull is exactly the same deal. Independent movement, independent fire. What about Total Carnage, Smash TV? Well, technically Smash TV was made by the boys at Williams, so they could have gotten away with it. My point is, games like Battlezone, right? Technically speaking, it's not independent motion, but it's got two joysticks, right? What about Frontline? What about games that used a combination of joystick and an analog substitute like a spinner, like Tron? Or Frontline, or Ikari Warriors. All of these games, everything could have been smashed by Williams had they wanted to do so. Right? If there were patent trolling going on in classic gaming, we would have been left out of a ton of different games. What about Karate Champ? Nobody remembers Karate Champ. I loved me some Karate Champ. Karate Champ, definitely a violator. But that, now, let's not even stop at classic games. Look at all the modern games that couldn't have been made. The, what was that, Mutant Storm, that one wouldn't have been made. Geometry Wars, the list goes on and on and on and on and on. Right now, I could probably download 10 knockoffs of Robotron and or Geometry Wars in a single swoop on the Android market because there's just that many of them. Twin stick shooters. Yeah, that's exactly my point. So, had we had patent trolling going on in the past, these are the sort of things we could have had left out. Tons of Laserdisc games came after Dragon's Lair, some of them arguably better than Dragon's Lair, and not from the Don Bluth company, not from Cinematronics, or from Rick Dyer. Us versus Them, Firefox, yada, 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 all of those games. See you in court, pal. None for you. No more, because we're going to stop you from copying us. These are the sort of things that make me absolutely crazy. My point is that there's a couple of different problems here. One, our patent system is completely broken. If you will allow somebody to patent a shape or a color, I don't think that the patent system is working the way that it should be. There are certain things, there are certain factors that should go into effect here, right? Did the fact that Black Widow copied Robotron, let's be honest, Black Widow is Robotron with a vector screen. Is there a couple of things in there? Yeah, that are different. But is it really Robotron? Yeah, kind of. Right? So tell me, did Black Widow, using twin stick shooting controls, using the wave after wave of enemies on the screen, which is remarkably like Robotron, did that cost Williams any money? Would people who played Black Widow said, oh, you know what, this is too much like Robotron, I think I'll go play Robotron? No. The answer is no. The answer is, can you put a price, can you put damages on that? I say no. The biggest problem with the precedents that's being set by this Apple versus Samsung thing is that you're unable to own an idea anymore. Let me walk you through this. I know this leaves the retro gaming realm just a little bit, but I want to talk about this because I think it's important. Having an idea does not guarantee that it's yours. Let's say, for example, somebody invents something like a machine that lets you rent and return movies at it. Let's say you came up with it in 1982 and you called it the Video Vendor. You sketched it out on a napkin. You even had the internal mechanics written down. You had all of that figured out. But you were a 13-year-old kid. You had really no legal rights to patent anything. And, of course, you didn't have the money to patent it. So despite the fact that maybe you came up with the idea first and the idea belongs to you, somebody called Redbox patents it. They patent a video dispensing device for films and video games. So they patent it. They've got a couple million sitting in the bank. They've got a team of crackpot lawyers. Did I say crackpot? That was a Freudian slip. I meant crackshot lawyers. But crackpot works pretty good for lawyers, too. So they have this crackshot group of lawyers. Now, the 13-year-old boy is now a man. And he says, well, look at that. Somebody took my idea and turned it into a $1 million-a-year business. Great. Where's my cut? I came up with that idea. I came up with that idea 30 years ago. Have it sitting on a napkin right here. Well, guess what? I didn't patent it, so I can't claim it. So I try to file some sort of an injunction. I try to plead my case, and I have to take it to court. And I say, listen, I've got a napkin that you can carbon date back to 1982 that shows I did this first. Where's my royalty check, please? You can have it. I don't want to run Redbox. I'll let you do it. You send me royalty checks. And Redbox says, nope, we got a patent. Do you have a patent? And I say, I'm sorry. The man says, no, I don't have a patent. And the judge says, well, that's just too bad. But it's like, it's my idea. I had it before these guys did. Well, I'm sorry, sir, you didn't patent it, so it's not your idea. So I appeal the decision, but of course I have very little money. I don't have a team of lawyers. And in the end, Redbox walks away with the video vendor that the man came up with 30 years ago. That's how it works. You don't have to invent anything. You have to be the first one to register it and have enough money in the bank to defend it. That's not innovation. It has nothing to do with innovation. In fact, it has a lot to do with imitation. And this is why people are upset about patent trolling. Because it doesn't prove that Samsung stole from Apple, because Apple stole from somebody else. Apple got the patent first, didn't have the idea first, but they somehow worded a patent that got through the patent office, and they have the financial warehouse to defend the patent. That's not the way it's supposed to work, man. It just isn't. Had Williams done this, we wouldn't have Geometry Wars. We wouldn't have tons and tons of games. We wouldn't have a game like Rise of Honor, Jet Li's Rise of Honor, right? Remember that? That was a game that used the second analog stick to actually fight, but they couldn't have made that game either. So here we have a concept of, can patenting stall creativity, stall innovation? How much did Apple lose based on Samsung? How much would Williams have lost if Black Widow came out with a dual stick shooter? Would people be playing Black Widow instead of Robotron? Probably not. Would people have bought an Apple product over a Samsung product? Probably not. How do you prove there were damages? But that's not the case in point here. The case in point is Apple managed to take something that had been drawn in movies, books, illustrations, actually written down in books, tablet PCs, tablet devices. Apple didn't make them. There's been a lot of cases of tablets well before Apple came up with them. Apple didn't make icons. You can give that to Xerox. I don't know why Xerox isn't suing the crap out of Apple. You know, the Apple screen, compare it to a Samsung TouchWiz screen, and it doesn't look all that similar. But compare an Apple iPod to one of the early PDAs that used the exact same icon lineup, the icon grid, the whole bit. Why aren't they suing Apple? No. Either they're not around anymore, or they weren't the one. They don't have a patent that words properly. It's all a bunch of litigious crap, and it's not helping anybody. It's not. Who's it helping? It's helping Apple. Is it helping Apple's consumers? Is it helping Android's consumers? Definitely not. Is it helping the industry? Would video games have progressed? Would we have games like Phoenix? Would we have games like Phoenix if Galaxian, was it Namco? If Namco had sued them for being too much like Galaxians? You know? There's so many things that we could look at and compare, where if you look back in our past, if you look back to classic gaming, old PC gaming, if you look back to those and you said, if the creators of Ultima saw Legacy of the Ancients and they said, that looks way too much like Ultima. We have the little stick figure walking through a top-down 2D world on the surface. You can't do that. We wouldn't have Legacy of the Ancients. We wouldn't have Questron. There are so many things that we would have not benefited from had this kind of patent trolling, had this sort of horrifying litigation happened back in our past, in our day, with our classic gaming, with something that means something to us. Maybe Apple versus Samsung doesn't mean anything to you, but it means something to somebody. I guarantee, you know, there are times in the past that there have been litigations with regards to Tetris and Donkey Kong, things like that. Mario, right? Great Giana Sisters got smacked down because it looked too much like Mario. I mean, that was shameless. I mean, the Great Giana Sisters even used the same level layout. You know, you're kind of asking for it then, right? My point is that this is not a new concept, but it's being taken to an extreme where it's no longer protecting one's assets. It's a race. It's a race to secure as many possible things. Slide to lock? Really? Last time I checked, my door had slide to lock features. So how is it that Apple can have a patent on that? Just saying. If you let this go too far, if you allow this to continue as a consumer, as a gamer, if you allow this sort of thing to continue, it does nothing more than set precedents that this is the right behavior. companies aren't going to have any money to innovate. They're not going to have any time to create new product, innovative product. They're going to be spending all of their time in court fighting patent laws. So, let us look back to Williams Electronics. Let us look back to Robotron. And let us say to ourselves, had Williams done what Apple has done, what would we have missed in hindsight? What would we have lost had Williams been Apple? Think of what we could miss in the future now that Apple is Apple. Something to think about. This month's anniversary is the fantastic, amazing, possibly one of the greatest arcade games of all time, Robotron. Robotron is 30 years old this year. It's hard to believe. I remember Robotron very clearly. It's a lot of games I don't remember clearly. I don't remember where I first played Phoenix. I don't remember where I first played Pac-Man. But I remember where I first played Robotron. Something interesting about Robotron. I have played a lot of games in my many, many years of being alive. I have played pretty much every console, almost every computer. And even with the multitude of new things coming in and day out, there's something new to play, there's something new to play, there's something new to play. There are certain games I go back to all the time. You know, there's movies that you watch every year, like Wizard of Oz or Miracle on 34th Street. There are certain things that you watch or do every year. For me, one of the things that I always come back to is Robotron. Robotron and Mr. Do. Anytime I get a new piece of hardware that's possible to run main, anytime I get a new control stick, anytime I get some new goodie and I can get MAME on it, I play Robotron and I play Mr. Do. The fact that these games are still fun, exciting, and fresh to me 30 years later isn't just a testament to brilliant programming. It's a testament to brilliant design. Games are kicked out, you know, a dime a dozen now, especially with the mobile market and the this flood of cheap 99-cent games. There's literally 10 games a day that you can play. Things didn't happen like that back in the old days. Let's talk about Robotron. There's so much history about Robotron we have to talk about. And then I'll share with you some of my personal experiences with Robotron. Well, if you've done your math, 30 years ago was 1982. A group called VidKids, formed in 1981, was actually a two-man team, Eugene Jarvis and Larry DeMar. Now, these guys left Williams to do their own thing. And they created a group called VidKids, because who knows why, right? There's always great stories. You know, look at Infinity Ward. That's all I'm saying. There's great stories to be had in some case, in some future event. I need to get Eugene Jarvis on the other end of the phone and talk to him, because I've got so many questions. He's also responsible, by the way, for one of my favorite games, Target Terror, in the arcade. Light game, digitized graphics. I'm a huge fan, but we're not here to talk about Target Terror. We're here to talk about Robotron. So these two left Williams in 1981 and to create VidKids. Under that name or that moniker, Eugene Jarvis and Larry DeMar created Stargate Blaster and, of course, Robotron. Now, Robotron is easily considered one of the hardest games of all time. The game is relentless. The game requires an incredible amount of concentration and skill. This is not an easy game, not even in the first few levels. Nowadays, they hand feed you everything. It's a participation ribbon for everybody these days. But back in those days, no sorry, Bob. This game is hard. Robotron's a raster, horizontal raster game, featuring, of course, the intuitive two controllers. Now, if you listen to the editorial commentary earlier, then you know that Robotron's been ripped off more times than I can count. Not just by blatant copying like Llamatron from Jeff Minner, but also games like Geometry Wars, Mutant Storm, you name it, there's about 10 gajillion Robotron knockoffs. And they're always happy to talk about how much like Robotron they are. Oh, this is so much like Robotron. It's like, no, it's not. You guys have failed. And of course, there's been sequels, Robotron X on the N64, and there's been various attempts to reboot the franchise, blah, blah, blah. But let's be honest. There is no other game like Robotron. Robotron ran on a 6809 Motorola CPU with mono sound using a very special sound, proprietary sound engine. This is very interesting. If you listen very closely to Robotron, now normally you don't have time to listen to it because you're busy getting your butt shot off or ran into or grunted, however you want to put it. It had a very interesting sound engine. Based on the needs of the game, it assigned priorities to the sound. So the sound of you getting killed or you firing always took precedence above, say, another sound, like the spawning of a creature or the brain shooting or one of the humans being abducted by the brain. All of these sounds were kind of layered because they didn't have a lot. They didn't have like 900 sound channels to work with, so they had to do the best they could. But they made sure that the sound priorities were done in a proper layering so that the game's audio fest, and it was, it's a feast. Robotron's an audio feast, as are all those Williams games. They made sure that the right sounds were in front. Now, see, that's an amazing thing. Just something very simple like that is something you take for granted, but you'd know it if it wasn't there, right? One of the other interesting things about this product is that it has a custom blitter. Now, blitter is something used to control large amounts of graphics at one time. Blitter was a very advanced concept, and the Amiga had its own custom blittering. Very few video game systems, very few computers had this custom blitter. And it really makes a difference when you're talking about literally hundreds of things on the screen at one time. So Robotron was loosely based on two different games, one being Berserk, and the other one being a Commodore Business Machines game, a pet, if you will, a pet game called Chase. Jarvis liked Berserk. He liked Berserk, but it bothered him that you only could fire in the direction you were moving. If you know Berserk, you know it's a very fast-paced, aggressive game, and the fact that you have to kind of stop moving to shoot something behind you, I don't think Jarvis liked that. Now, what he did like, though, was the fact that you could hold down the fire button, and you would freeze in motion, but then you could fire in any direction you wanted. You know, a lot of people don't know that about Berserk, which I find interesting. A lot of people play Berserk for years, and they don't know that if you hold down the fire button, you can independently fire in any direction while you're standing there. But he liked the concept of Berserk, but not the controls. And it was the same sort of idea with the Chase game as well. He liked the concepts behind Chase, but it didn't quite, it wasn't that arcade adrenaline rush that they were looking for. It took them 6 months to make Robotron. The neat thing about this was the fact that they weren't restricted to using a pre-built piece of hardware. If, for example, you're a developer and you're going to develop on, say, a Nintendo DS, you are required to utilize the control schemes that the Nintendo DS has, a D-pad, some buttons, some shoulder buttons. You have a microphone that you can use, a touch screen. You're locked in. You're locked into what the device offers you. Making arcade games was a different story. They could literally sit there and do whatever they wanted. So they grabbed a board from Stargate. Right? They grabbed a Stargate board and a couple of Atari 2600 controllers they had laying around, and they wired this thing up. And they created this unbelievably great game, Robotron. Interestingly enough, part of the inspiration for the two joystick control was the fact that Jarvis had had a car accident and one of his hands was in a cast. So he couldn't really use a button controller. So he decided to opt to use double joysticks. The rest is sort of history, right? It's amazing how, I find it fascinating, quite frankly, that the luck of the draw, I mean, I don't think he considered it lucky he had a car accident, but sometimes you almost have to believe in divine intervention when something like this comes along, right? Had he not been in the car accident, had he not had his hand in the cast, Robotron may have been a joystick with a four-button system, right, where you could fire in four directions with four buttons, as so many Robotron games have done since. But because of the car accident, because of the cast, the man wanted a second joystick. He also wanted the precision that the second joystick would offer. So they had the basic concept. They had some basic hardware. So originally, they started off by making the game not a shooter, which I find fascinating as well. The game didn't start as a shooter. It started as a more passive game where you led robots around a playfield trying to get them to run into the electrodes to kill them. There was no shooting at all. But unfortunately, that didn't really add to the excitement. It was a little too passive, right? Arcade games need to be this massive shot of rush that you keep dropping quarters in to get it over and over and over and over and over again. So they decided to let them shoot. And that's, of course, where that precision of shooting came into play. They chose a single screen. None of these designs were left by chance. This is what's cool. Every single thing was thought out and tweaked and tested over and over and over again until they got exactly the right recipe. I don't think that happens anymore. No offense to modern game designers. I don't think that people have, not the skill set to do this, but the leisure of doing this. You're under deadlines. There's $2 bajillion on the line. Everyone's saying, when are you going to get it done? You've got to talk to the art department. You've got to talk to the sound department. You got 17 programming teams. You have a team lead. You have a PM, blah, 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 blah. So you don't really have the ability to sit back and go, man, you know what? I think we can change this. You know, I think we can tweak this just a little bit. And Jarvis and DeMar did all of their own playtesting, and they sat there and made tweak after tweak after tweak until it was just right. They chose that single screen. Now, remember, Defender, Stargate, scrolling games, right? They had the graphical power to make it a scrolling game, but they decided that if you used a single cramped screen and put the player right in the middle of it, and threw a whole bunch of robots around him, that immediate threat would be present every single level. Absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. They chose a black background. Didn't have to have a black background. They chose a black background and very simplistic graphics. They didn't have to do simplistic graphics either. But you'll notice that the artwork in a Robotron is almost primitive. Done on purpose to help reduce clutter. Right, they had to work on colors and you have to have different types of colors that overlap each other, yada yada. It's crazy. I would not have wanted to have been part of that project. It sounds absolutely crazy, but nothing was left to chance. So they created this Orwellian world, right? The whole idea. 1984 was too close, right? It was 2 years in the future, so they didn't want to use 1984 as, you know, Robotron 2084. They decided, instead of using 1984, which they probably would have gotten sued by patent trolls, whoever the publisher was of 1984. Sorry, just couldn't resist. So they chose to put it in the very, very distant future, 2084. So they came up with this concept that, the robots essentially got cognizant. They got smart. They decided to eliminate all the humans. Story we've seen a million times, right? Good thing they weren't patent trolls, because then we wouldn't have gotten things like, Terminator or what was the other recent flick like that? Matrix, right? None of those things would have been able to be done. Sorry, I'm still a little bit bitter about patent trolling. Anyway, so they created this Orwellian world, but there was a piece missing from it. you had robots. There was lots of killing going on. They loved it. I mean, they absolutely went nuts over it. They knew they had a winner. But there was something missing. And had Robotron been missing this aspect of the game, it never would have been the same game. And it would have never been the masterpiece that it is. Humans. Not just content to kill the bad guys. We need a rescue element. They liked the rescue element that they had in Defender and Stargate. That is, rescuing humanoids. So they added humans with a very specific character, right? Mommy, Daddy, Mikey. There was something that required you, in your mind, mentally. If they were just coins or boxes, right? Who cares? You're not saving boxes, but if you're saving humans, something that looks like you, oh, there you go. Again, nothing left to chance. So they added the rescue element to it. Well, the first thing they did, of course, was create the electrodes and the grunts. Now, the grunts were always supposed to take a very short, fast path, keeping the player on the run and be the mass swarm, right? When you see 900 of these damn things attacking you, it's scary, and it puts you in that imminent danger. They kept adding more and more and more, and they realized that the more of them they put on there, the more fun it was. Oddly enough, right? Other enemies were added to foster some variety, right? Hulks were added based slightly on the indestructible ball from Berserk, right? Because you can't destroy Hulks. All you could do is kind of push them with your bullets a little bit. The levitating enforcers were added to shoot back at the player, and they're spawned by the spheroids. The enforcers used a great AI system, which for the time was amazing. And here's the secret to that. These are the ones that they kind of make that really annoying grating sound. They sit in the corner and they lob these shots at you. Well, they knew the fact that you'd be moving all the time, that if they shot a direct beam at you or a direct bullet at you, you were probably going to be gone by the time it got there. So they used an AI routine to shoot at a 10-pixel random area around the player, and they added some random acceleration to the trajectory. And believe me, anybody who's played Robotron knows that that's absolutely brilliant, and it tends to get you more times than not. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. The brains were added to throw a little monkey in the wrench, if you will. These would convert your humans into progs. Nasty little beasts that took away from the ability to rescue. Plus, you know, the humans couldn't be hurt by anybody else, right? So they just sat there on the screen. Now, the Hulks eventually ended up killing them. And the brains would adapt them into these progs, very much like the Borg, so that we wouldn't have Borg if Williams had been patent trolls too. I swear I'm going to stop. I swear it. Finally, to up the difficulty level, they added tanks, right? They have bouncing projectiles along with the little quirky things that spawn the tanks. That rounds out Robotron. Those are the enemies. That's how it works. And let's be honest, the game is still to date, personally, I'm a huge fan of greed games. Games that entice you to take chances with the promises of big rewards in exchange for risking your life. That's my definition of greed games, and Robotron is it. Let's just say that they'd made every human worth 1,000 points. Not enough greed in that. So they made them incrementally increase. The first one's worth 1,000. The second one's worth 2,000. Right? So the more you're willing to be greedy, even the reward was incremental. Amazing. Again, these are not things left to chance. These were purposefully done things. Brilliant video game making. Period. So, about 19,000 of the cabinets were sold, which was considered a huge success in 1982. There were later on cabaret and cocktail versions were released, and let's just say they're rare. I have never personally seen a cabaret or a cocktail Defender. I'm sorry, Robotron. Sorry, I had Defender on my notes sitting right here. And they are highly prized collectibles. And even the original cabinets are fetch top dollar, right? So Robotron has managed to spend a 30-year history of delighting gamers, challenging gamers. It's a game you can't win, which is also very cool. Today's games, every game now, oh, you can win. There's an end. 20 hours of storyline, and then it's over, and you win. Right? There's no end to Robotron. You can't beat it. All you can do is get farther. And there is a magic to that. Just like the addictive properties of Geometry Wars and all of the games that followed it, that piggybacked on those principles. Geometry Wars is a brilliant game. But let's be honest. Without Robotron, there would not be Geometry Wars. Because if you look at the elements in Geometry Wars and you tore them down one unit at a time, you would find more Robotron in there than anything else. And I'm not trying to cut down the developers of Geometry Wars, Bizarre Creations, because they did a great job. My point is, had there been patent trolls? No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. Get off the patent trolls. Okay, so Robotron, that's sort of your history lesson, right? That's where Robotron came from. Currently, Robotron still fetches a very high price. Other games of 1982 of similar makeup and style, Robotron always commands a higher dollar value than other games. It's also one of the games that gets beat the crap out of. If you do happen to find a Robotron machine, chances are likely the joysticks are ground to practically nothing. I know, because at Castles and Coasters, which is where I play my arcade retro games, their joysticks are ground to nothing, and it's almost impossible to play a really good game, because it does require literally split-second timing all the time to play Robotron. So let's talk about Robotron from my perspective, right? As somebody who grew up with the game, I mean, I could sit here and quote Wikipedia crap to you all day, but let's be honest. Robotron is to be enjoyed, right? The first time I played Robotron, for those of you who are old fans of the show, know that I worked at a place called the Rec Center. And the Rec Center was a privately owned place, a friend of my mother's, actually, named Ben Wilson, who is deceased. The guy smoked like 12 packs a day. He wasn't long for this world, all right? But he was a very nice, generous guy. He gave my mom, a single mother, a job, took care of her. I don't think he was doing anything else with her. I'm hoping not. But that's a whole different story. Maybe I'll talk about that on Passenger Seat Radio. It's a little less family-friendly over there. But my point being that Ben ran the rec center, and my mom always had a job. She would take me with her in the mornings to help, right? So she didn't have a babysitter, and there was no dad in the picture. So she would take me to the rec center with her. We'd go in the very early morning, 5 or 6 in the morning. And my job was to spray the machines down, clean them, clean all of the pool tables, vacuum. So there were a lot of things to be done. So I helped out. The cool thing, of course, is that I had access to all of these arcade games with nobody around. Now, I know what you're thinking. Did you get to play them for free? No, he was a nice guy, but not that nice of a guy. Those of you who know the incident with the Pac-Man machine knows what happens when you try to get games for free. And, of course, Space Invaders was easy to get free credits on as well. All you had to do was lift the glass up, pull it out just a little bit, stick your hand in there, and knock off about 10 million credits. But, you know, when you have exciting games around like Robotron and Dragon's Lair and all these other games, the Space Invaders machine leaves you kind of cold. So I played Robotron first there. And, of course, it was a great quarter eater. But at that point in time, I was more interested in Dragon's Lair, that sort of thing. My real addiction to Robotron didn't come until later. Now, Robotron has been released on, like, every platform on the planet. You can get it for every gaming console as part of Midway Collections or Williams Collections. You can get it with MAME, of course. You can get it emulated. You can play it on Shockwave's site. There's a number of different places you can play it. Unfortunately, there are very few places that you can play it correctly. That is, with two real joysticks. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, well, Shane, Xbox controller has two analog sticks, and PlayStation 2, PlayStation 3 have two analog sticks, and the Wii controller have two sticks. Let's be honest. If you've ever played 9 or 10 levels into Robotron, you get a little worked up. And when you get worked up, there is nothing that matches two hardcore, real arcade controller joysticks in your hand. The analog sticks on the controllers leave you a little empty. And if you really want to talk about playing the game incorrectly, try playing it with a touch screen, like on a tablet. I'm telling you, there are tons of these Robotron wannabe games kicking around on the tablets with pure touch controls. And let's be honest, I would rather play it with a keyboard, which I have done. I have actually played Robotron with the keyboard quite a bit, actually, back before I had actual arcade controls kicking around the house. Some interesting stories about Robotron. One of the things I remember the most about Robotron, outside of Robotron, is Llamatron. And Llamatron was I would call it a satire versus a ripoff. Llamatron was a game developed by Jeff Minner, who is responsible for Tempest 2000, Attack of the Mutant Camels. You know the guy's name. You've played his games, okay? He created a Robotron game called Llamatron, and it came out on a bunch of platforms. I played it mostly on the Amiga. And it was one of those ones where it shot in whatever direction that you were moving towards, right? So it wasn't the greatest game of Robotron, but at the time, it's what we had. You know what I'm saying? It's what we had. So I played a lot of Llamatron. Oddly enough, though, I didn't get into many of the dual-stick shooters of the day. I played a lot of Karate Champ, but I wouldn't call that a dual-stick shooter. I did play a lot of Cloak and Dagger, but it wasn't around very long. It was at the rec center for just a little while. Krull. Oh, my God. I loved Krull. First of all, I loved the movie Krull. And we had the game in the rec center for like 2 seconds. In fact, you know what? I don't even think it was at the rec center. It was at one of the local arcades. And if you've never played Krull, you should. Is it the greatest game? No. But it's got those cool kind of glowing graphics like the MCR games do, like Satan's Hollow, right? And Rampage. It's got those kind of glowing graphics, and it's got just incredible sound. Now, I got to interview the guy that did the sounds for Krull, and, you know, he was pleased that somebody appreciated his work, because not a lot of people appreciated the video game Krull. But Smash TV, Total Carnage, I didn't really get into those games, and I think it was because I was too PC or computer focused at that point in time to be playing arcade games. All of my money went into Commodore 64 stuff or whatever. So Robotron kind of sat on the back burner. Then MAME came out, and I got to rekindle a lost flame in Robotron. And ever since then, ever since MAME has been available, I have played Robotron. Now, this is very interesting. I'm going to tell you a little story. There was a point in time where some of you remember Ron Corcoran. He ran Snipercade. I can't tell you much about Ron Corcoran. But what I will tell you is there was one point in time when myself, Ron Corcoran, and a couple other dudes were lured away from our jobs to work for a startup called Custom Arcade. This guy was a consummate snake oil salesman. He made Steve Jobs look like a saint, this guy. He made lots of promises, gifts exchanged. Well, not a lot of gifts exchanged. He never paid us. Promises were made. So we actually quit our jobs. Good paying jobs, too, I might add. Because this was my dream, right? I was going to actually work for a video game company, this Custom Arcade. And this guy had their hook, Custom Arcade's hook, was an interchangeable control panel right? Let's say you wanted to play a, let's say you wanted a cheap solution, right? You could get a custom arcade with a single player six button panel. You could then take that control panel off and put a different control panel on. Two players, six buttons each. You could take that off and put one player with a trackball. Any sort of Tron controls, whatever. The idea was is that you bought the unit and you interchanged the tops. That was sort of the deal. Seemed pretty sound to me. I liked the idea. I thought it was a sound idea. They asked me, because I had just finished, well, I hadn't quite finished work, but I was working on a variety of different games under Dark Unicorn Productions, for those of you who remember. And they wanted, the guy wanted Dark Unicorn to be making a game that might resonate with the classic gaming industry, right? It was kind of, I mean, Dark Unicorn wasn't huge, but there was a name out there. And, you know, I was working on a whole bunch of things back then, Dino Eggs and VS Ball. There was a whole bunch of different things back at that point in time that I had kicking around. Well, one of the things I always wanted to do was make Meteor Blast. Meteor Blast was an extension of Astro Smash, right? I loved Astro Smash on the Intellivision. It's one of the only Intellivision games I ever played, really. And Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. Custom Arcade wanted me to work on an Astro Smash clone. But they wanted it modernized, right? Something that you could play with an arcade stick that would really put some fire under the Astro Smash gameplay. So I created a game called Meteor Blast, which I gotta admit was some of my best work. Unfortunately, I was under contract with Custom Arcade at the time of development. So my day consisted of getting up in the morning, driving over to Ron Corcoran's house. That was our base of operations. We would go there, and that's where I would code. I would sit there and code 8 hours a day on this Astro Smash clone, or this, yeah, the Meteor Blaster. So I would go up there, and this is, Ron Corcoran was a huge Robotron fan, as were the other guys, right? As part of our corporate edict, every single day, we started with a half hour of Robotron, right? We would actually sit and play Robotron as a way to charge ourselves up and get us ready for the workday. How cool is that? So that lasted a few months before we finally figured out this guy was a ripoff artist. He was never going to pay us. Then he paid us a couple of dollars, but it wasn't what he promised. Turns out that he had grifted that from somebody at the Western Union building. Wow. Believe me, there's an entire story there that unfortunately I can't get into. But my point is, I played a lot of Robotron. And Robotron was, for a while, something I did every single workday. So there's something about that, and I'm so glad that I didn't get a negative connotation with that, right? Because normally, if you'd been screwed, almost starved your family out, quit a great job, and you got screwed over by a snake oil salesman, you would think that pretty much anything in that era would be dirty to you. Fortunately, Robotron was not. And since then, I have built a MAME cabinet, I've had numerous computers, I've had numerous portable devices, a PSP, anything I could run MAME on, one of the very first things I do is play Robotron on it. That's how important Robotron is to me. And I know Robotron is very important to several of my listeners that that actually own Robotron machines and play it literally every day. There's something special about that. There's something special about a game that can live on 30 years. People are still playing it. We're going to talk about the Church of Robotron later on when we talk about bits and bytes. Yeah, there's a church for people into Robotron. We're going to talk about that. I guarantee you that in 30 years, Call of Duty will be no more. I guarantee you in 30 years, no one will have even heard of Angry Birds. I guarantee you in 30 years, there will be no Halo. I guarantee you in 30 years, there's a lot of things that seem eternal that will be nothing. Yet here's a game running out of 1 megahertz 6809 CPU written by two guys in their basement with a Stargate board and a couple of 2600 controllers strapped up to it that lives in infamy forever. as long as the people are alive, I think, that love this game. As long as these people can still put two controllers in either hand. I mean, that's the great thing. You get arthritis and you can't like grasp very good. You can just put your hands on top of the controllers and move them. I can be 80 years old and still play Robotron. I ain't going to be playing Halo when I'm 80, I'll tell you that. I ain't going to be playing Call of Duty. I'm certainly not going to be playing Angry Birds. But my guess is 30 years from now, Robotron's 60th anniversary. Heaven forbid I'm still doing this show. But I guarantee you in 30 more years, on whatever three-dimensional holographic place that I'm in, no matter where I am, no matter what medium gaming can be done on, if there's a three-dimensional holodeck right out of Star Trek, I'll be in an 80s arcade playing Robotron. Something to think about. Well, I hope you enjoyed our anniversary look at Robotron. We, of course, have tons of anniversaries to continue going through. Some of the big ones we haven't even hit yet, like the Commodore 64 and the Amiga. And I want to make sure that they all get their due. So we're going to continue the anniversary series next month. But we've still got plenty of show for you right here on Retro Gaming Radio. Stay tuned. It's time once again for the venerable Bits and Bytes segment. That is news sent in by listeners just like you. So let's get started. First up, Martin Parrott sends us in a latest development on Scum VM. Now, Scum is the emulator that allows you to run the old point-and-click adventure games like King's Quest, Monkey Island, Day of the Tentacle, Beneath a Steel Sky, tons of different games that it's compatible with. And again, this is an emulator, so you still have to provide the actual code. But Martin wanted to let us know, this is slightly old now because it's a month old news, but sorry about that. Scum VM 1.5 is out, and this adds support for a game called Once Upon a Time Little Red Riding Hood, as well as a handful of other games. And I'll read you the list here in case you're not able to see it. Backyard Baseball 2003, Blue Force, Darby the Dragon, Dreamweb, Geisha, Gregory and the Hot Air Balloon, Magic Tales, Liam Finds a Story, Sleeping Club's Test of Courage, Salties and the Princess and the Crab. Now, I can honestly say I've heard of one of those, and that's Dreamweb. But I'm sure there are plenty of point-and-click adventure people who are jumping for joy that Scum is available now to play those titles for you. Okay. Moving along, Ronald Smith, regular contributor, would like to tell us about a new Odyssey 2 game, which is incredible, right? We always see new 2600 games. We see new Nintendo games that people have put together. But Odyssey 2, that's outside the box, right? Well, this is called Mage the Enchanted Crystals. It's from Revival Studios. And let me give you the game list of features here. It's playable on VideoPak and Odyssey 2 consoles, high-resolution background on VideoPak Plus consoles, multicolored backgrounds and sprites, digitized speech using the voice add-on, internet high score uploading, whoa, and online reward system. That's crazy. This is an Odyssey 2. It actually looks kind of cool. They've got a video for you to take a look at. You're probably watching it right now. Compliments of Alex J. Lopez sending you videos. Again, I say this every single time one of these sort of games shows up. It blows my mind. The internet uploading? That's absolutely crazy. Did these guys actually go through the time to develop for these long, quote-unquote, dead systems? So, congratulations on that. That looks great. You can't go wrong with this sort of stuff. You keep sending this stuff in. I love to see these games. Next up, Andy writes in, and he actually had a question as well as wanting me to point to you to these Dragon's Lair walkthrough videos. Individual Biff's Gaming Videos, big YouTube channel, 406 videos are available. Not all Dragon's Lair. But the goal of this particular series is to walk you through Dragon's Lair step by step through each scene of Dragon's Lair. And as a bonus, he gives you the moves for several different platforms, including the Digital Leisure Edition, the arcade in the hard mode, CDI, and ReadySoft versions. Well, how about that, huh? So you actually can play it on your platform of choice as well. The question that I was asked by Andy was, is the Move system accurate for the fire ropes in the video that they sent? Now, oddly enough, the video that was sent in shows what I call the long version of the ropes, which very few people that I know ever actually did. However, it is incorrectly the only move on many home versions of the game. And let me explain. In Dragon's Lair, for those of you who don't know what Dragon's Lair is, I'm not going to go at it endlessly yet again. But suffice to say, it's an interactive movie, more like QuickTime Events than an actual quote-quote video game. It's an interactive movie. At one point in time, Dirk comes across this large, gaping, fire-laden obstacle. And he must swing across these ropes to get to the other side. Now, in many of the home versions, and many of the console versions, and so far too many versions, the game will not let you immediately go for the rope. It makes you wait until the platform that you're standing on starts to pull back into the wall. And just as you're about ready to fall into the flames, you can quickly tap to the left or the right and jump over and catch the ropes. That's what's shown in the video. However, if you look at the lettering around the video, it does tell you that you are allowed to make a move ahead of time, early, which is what I'm talking about. The second the rope swings into Dirk's reach, before the platform starts moving, you can actually move. Unfortunately, far too many versions of Dragon's Lair do not let you do that. It's one of my main complaints when looking for authenticity in a Dragon's Lair title. But back to the original news article. This is a complete walkthrough from front to back. Fantastic, right? I mean, this guy does tons of other stuff too, but this gives you an idea of the guy's dedication to making these videos, and they're very useful. So if you've ever wanted to do Dragon's Lair from front to back, and you just never had the time, or you didn't want to use the on-screen move list, or you're interested in alternate moves, this is where you need to go. Always nice to see Dragon's Lair-related news, you know me. Alex J. Lopez sends us in an anniversary good wish for the TRS-80 computer. Now, I've got a story to tell you about the TRS-80. At some point in time, I'm going to do an anniversary, so maybe I shouldn't talk about it, because I'd like to talk more about this. Oh, my God, it's the game I actually played on there, too. Wow, okay, forget it. I'm just going to tell you about the story. This is the first computer I ever touched. A TRS-80 Model 3, 16K of memory. Not megabytes, not gigabytes, 16 kilobytes of memory with the tape drive you see pictured in the picture on the link. Amazingly enough, what's on the screen on the monitor on this picture is one of the two games I distinctly remember playing, which is a Star Trek game. This totally hooked me into computers. What you're seeing right here, this computer, had I not seen this computer and touched this computer, I probably would not be who I am today. I mean, there's a pivotal point in everybody's life when there's a crossroads in everybody's life. This computer was solely responsible for my involvement with gaming, with my involvement in computers, with my involvement in programming. Everything stemmed from this computer. So it deserves a huge round of applause. So the other game that I played religiously on this, and I'm going to tell you a good story about how I actually got in contact with one of these. The other game I played was based on an Aztec theme. It was a text adventure where you could type in two word commands like go left, go north, go south, open box, that sort of thing. And I remember every time you did something wrong, the standard death was your body is riddled with shafts. No matter what you did wrong, that seemed to be the ending. So if you opened the wrong door, if you went the wrong way, your body was riddled with shafts. A lot of you remember that. So how did I actually get my paws upon a TRS-80 Model 3 computer? Back in, let's see, let me do the math here. Hang on, wait a minute. I'm not super quick at this. If it's 35 years old, so 30 years back would be 82, so that'd be what, 78? I would have been 9 years old, which would have put me in third grade. So, Okay, I must Model 3, a couple years ahead. So I was in fifth grade at the time. So fifth grade, that would make me 11. That would be 69 to 79. So 1980. There you go. That's pretty close, right? That sounds like the right math. When I was in grade school, when I was in elementary school, whatever you guys call it across the pond, what do the English people call it primary, right? Primary school. Anyway, when I was in fifth grade, 11 years old, I was not obviously popular with the other children. We lived in a rural community, and if you weren't wearing jeans and flannel shirts and squishing bugs and cutting down trees and riding motorcycles, well, you were pretty much an outcast, even at that age, So I didn't have a lot of friends, and they had a gifted, talented program at the school. Now, the program was barely funded. They had one computer, and they had to service an entire school district. Now, out in the middle of nowhere, a school district wasn't 10 city blocks. It was more like 100 square miles. So we saw this woman who ran the Gifted Talented program. We saw her once a week on Wednesdays. I remember specifically. And on Wednesday, they would pull me and several other gifted, talented students out of class, and we got to go do unbelievable gifted, talented things. They would have us solving advanced mathematical stuff. They'd have us do advanced puzzle solving, that sort of thing. It's sort of like a mini Mensa back in those days. Well, we would only see this person every Wednesday, and we didn't get rotation into the computer except for once a month. So like the third Wednesday of the month, we would get to play on this computer. And believe me, this was it. This was the time frame that fashioned who I am. Was playing with this computer and looking at the code for Star Trek and all this stuff is simply amazing. So the TRS-80 has a huge, huge spot in my heart, and I want to give it its due for its 35 years. Thank you. Thank you, Radio Shack. Thank you, TRS-80. TSR, I've got Dark Tower and Dungeons & Dragons on my head right now. But I owe a great amount of debt to this particular computer you're looking at on this screen right here, because I owe it a lot. Let's put it that way. Okay, next up, Alex J. Lopez again submits to us, what would modern video games look like, what would the cartridges look like if they were shipped on 2600 cartridges? So if you go over here, you can see Beatles Rock Band, Batman Arkham Asylum, Borderlands, Company of Heroes, Dead Island, Limbo. That's what these games would look like if they were put on 2600 cartridges with 2600 game art. You imagine that? BioShock on the 2600? I'm thinking it might lack just a little something. Let's see. Next up, Chris Hull always likes to give us some good stuff. Corporal punishment in video gaming. So this is an article from Hackaday. I think Chris Hull either works for them or sits on that site all the time, because he constantly submits articles from here. So I'm going to read this, the first little piece of this to you, because it's pretty funny. It's only a couple paragraphs. So as if getting your ass handed to you while playing video games wasn't annoying enough, we decided the best way to help improve the skills was by inflicting physical pain each time the on-screen character died. While perusing the internet looking for something to break through the doldrum of the day, he came across a video in which somebody decided to try on a dog shock collar just for kicks. This sparked the imagination. He started to think that it would be pretty cool to use the same sort of device to make dying in video game that much more unpleasant. After a set of dog collars online, he tore them apart to see how they functioned and measured just how big of a jolt they were able to deliver. Then modified two Genesis controllers with a pair of A-Tiny 25s, know what that is, which let him send a fire signal to the collars. Unfortunately, stock Genesis games don't allow you to send signals to the controllers, so they had to spend some time hacking together ROM images to trigger events when players were injured or lose a life. We think the project's pretty slick, and if you don't mind fiddling with your old controllers, you too can have a merciless trainer strapped around your neck. For those slightly more adverse to pain, you can watch the video with him and his friends suffering the consequences of poor gameplay for your amusement. How fun is that, right? You're going to play video games, you're going to pay. I love it. Gary Adamson, another great contributor to the show, would like us to know about Kickstarter, another Kickstarter project for a Shadowrun game on Linux. Let's see what we got here. So they want to recreate Shadowrun online with your friends and enemies in a true cross-platform game. Let's see, for online, Mac, PC, Linux, pretty much everything, Android, tablet, iOS, based on a turn-based RPG set in the award-winning world of Shadowrun. Create one account and play your game across multiple devices, whichever way you prefer. So they're trying to reinvigorate an online version. They were looking for $500,000, and they got it. They got 6,000 backers, and they were fully funded August 14th. So good for you guys. I like to see these sort of projects funded. I can't wait to see how it works. If you want more information, you can go to Shadowrun.com. Of course, we will have links for you as well. Let's see. Next up, Keith Haddad sends in a great video. I don't know how I missed this one. This is a Jim Butterfield video. Now, Jim Butterfield was sort of like, he did a lot of programming for the Commodore 64. He was an icon. I mean, when you think C64 and you think about the people that surrounded it, Jim Butterfield was there. And this is a 2-hour documentary of Jim Butterfield showing you all about the Commodore 64, how to hook it up, how to program it, and what to do with it. I mean, he even goes into machine language stuff. It's crazy. I didn't get a chance to watch the whole thing, but I skimmed through it and listened to Jim drone on. He's not the greatest speaker, but the guy's brilliant. And apparently not that great of a guy, apparently, from the people who knew him. I know a couple of guys who knew him and said that he wasn't the nicest guy. But, you know, that's hearsay, right? Judge Judy wouldn't allow me to have that in court. That's hearsay. So that's cool. If you get a chance, you want to watch Jim Butterfield explain the Commodore 64 to you. That's good stuff. And from me comes something I must have, and I must have it right now. This is a fully decked out Android-based main cabinet. And we've seen a ton of these. We've seen iCade. We've seen all this stuff. But you just got to see this thing. It's beautiful. It's called Main Station. I don't understand why I can't buy one of these right now. Right now. So take a look at this thing. Let me see if I got anything in here that I can actually, they managed to build the ultimate mini MAME machine incorporating a Lenovo K1 tablet, Android 404, MAME for Droid with over 8,000 games, which I'm sure they legally own every single one of them, and a Wii, Capcom fighting stick connected via Bluetooth, all neatly packaged inside a custom cabinet whose building plans are locked away in a top secret facility, which means we don't get to have one. I like this guy. How dare he tease us with such epicness and then keep its secrets to himself? I gotta have one of those. Somebody get me one of those. Please. Tell the guy I need it. Let's see. I wish people would write me and tell me how to pronounce their name. I'm assuming this is a version of Hugh. Hughes Johnson. It's H-U-G-U-E-S. I hate mispronouncing people's names. It makes me crazy. He submitted a little something from the Retro League. Now, the Retro League, he wanted to, of course, he thanked me for being the inspiration. He's a huge fan of the show. I guess I should have listened to one of the shows, right? I'm sure he would have said his name. That is a fail on my part. You know, I love to promote anything that has to do with retro gaming. I want people to check out this podcast. And I guess I'm going to have to check it out now, too. I just don't have that much free time. But it looks like pretty good stuff. For those of you who are more interested in the Nintendo, Super Nintendo type eras, the fourth generation, fifth generation of video game retro gamingness, it looks like this guy covers a lot more of that sort of stuff. Just poking through his list here, Saturn, Virtual Console stuff, let's see, Dreamcast, right? So he's kind of the next generation past what I tend to cover. So pretty good, right? So give it a try, and if anybody's listened to it, let us know. Let my other listeners know what you think of it, and I'm going to have to find one that speaks directly to me. You guys know I'm not a huge NES or Super NES fan, but there's obviously some Dreamcast stuff in here, some PlayStation stuff, so I'm going to have to get in on that. The Retro League. So thanks for submitting that. Ronald Smith sends us in an article. This is Creative, Compelling, and Canceled, Lost Games That Could Have Shaken the System. This is 9 daring games that proved too unorthodox for the mass market. So I'll read you the list of games, and you can go back and check out the article yourself. Cabbage for the Nintendo 64, Sega VR for Genesis, Highbound for Virtual Game Boy, Penn & Teller's Smoke and Mirrors for Sega CD, BC for Xbox, Tyrannosaurus Tex for Game Boy Color, Crank the Weasel for Xbox PlayStation 2, Bounty Arms for PlayStation, The Incredible Shrinking Character for PC, PlayStation, and Saturn. So there you go. And it's got a nice little couple paragraph write-up on each one in terms of what happened and why it got the plug pulled on it, that sort of thing. So, more good stuff for your reading entertainment. Andrew Driver, another great contributor, always likes to send something in every month. Now, this is huge to me. This is a huge deal for me. I'm a huge pinball fan. My first experience with pinball on a PC, of course, I played all of the pinball fantasies, illusions, dreams, and stuff on the Amiga, and I liked them at the time. But I'm not so much of a scrolling screen epic pinball kind of guy. I like the 3D perspective from the end of the pinball table looking in perspective, you know, like all pinball machines are done today. Well, in the early days, there weren't that many out for the PC. Most of them were very fantasy-oriented, like Sierra had one, right, that had dinosaurs and tables that couldn't possibly exist. It wasn't very realistic. But there were a few tables, Slam Tilt Pinball, which in the United States was released as Hyper 3D Pinball. Hyper 3D Pinball, my wife and I must have played 100 hours apiece on that. Had some great tables, had great physics, at least for the time, fantastic music. It was great. Well, not soon after that came somebody who really, they really wanted to pull out the stops and create the most realistic pinball ever created. This was made by Empire Interactive, and they made 4 different tables. Now, whereas many pinball games give you multiple tables when you buy it, you got one. And they were called The Web, Time Shock, Big Race USA, and Fantastic Journey. One table per purchase, but these tables were real. I mean, they weren't based on real licenses, but there is nothing about any of these tables that you would not think was 100% authentic. So, we have here a Kickstarter project. They would like to bring this back. They would like to do a Kickstarter and bring back pro pinball. Now listen, I'll take as much pinball you people are going to put out. I will donate. I will pledge. Get me more pinball. I want it, and pro pinball was fantastic. If I could have those 4 tables back on my Android tablet, totally there. So good. More quality Kickstarters out there. I dug up a video here called Should We Worry About Preserving the Retro Games We Love? And this is not the greatest interview, mind you, but the guy's got good things to say. I actually got through this one. He talks about the same things we all talk about. It's just nice to know that there are other like-minded people. That, you know, he talks about the things about retro games that a lot of people don't think about. And this was, you know, this is sort of one of those mainstream stories, sort of one of those, you know, I think this is actually a weekend story. I don't remember. You know, on weekends, these big game sites and stuff, like, kind of put in, like, quote, filler to fill in the weekends, you know, stuff that's not, doesn't need to be put out right now. So it was kind of one of those filler stories, but it's worth your time to watch the video, and it's something that you can share with others to help them explain why video gaming, and especially retro gaming, is so important to you. Now, I'm trying to get a handle on this one. Christopher Hull sends in Church of Robotron. Now, we talked about Robotron. This was our anniversary coverage, and believe me, I am all about the Robotron. If anybody would be a member of the Church of Robotron, to be me. But I never knew about this. This is a guy who gets up on a pulpit and talks about what you can learn from Robotron. And I can't even explain it to you. You're going to have to just get on there and you're going to have to look at it. Needless to say, you're a Robotron fan. You need to get out here. Okay? This has to just be seen to be appreciated. That people will go to this extent. Now see, I love Robotron. And you should have heard it, how much I loved the Robotron. This looks like this guy is in an abandoned church speaking the gospel of Robotron. Never mind. Just go see it. Just go see it. Church of Robotron. Churchofrobotron.com. How about that? Here's another one of those cool things. A rare 2600 cartridge popped up in a Philly game shop. I've never even heard of this, but based on the article, it sounds like this is the real deal. A game called Red Sea Crossing. Red Sea Crossing. This was made by a guy named Steve Stack. Apparently there were 100 of these things. Yeah. So they have a legitimate one right here. And they're going to put it up for auction, I think, or up for sale. But anyway, it's neat to see these sort of things. At least we got a picture of it. It's neat to see these things that are of legend pop back up and jump out in your face and go, look, here I am. There's only 100 of me, you know. Take note. So, yeah, that was cool. That was cool. That was sent by Alex J. Lopez, by the way. Alex also sends in a bulletin board related piece of information. This will allow you to... This is going to give you the complete, this will give you the complete schematics and everything on how to build and experience a bulletin board environment. So you're going to build a board. You're going to, write some basic code. It's going to let you connect to and give you the ability to connect to a bulletin board, an actual bulletin board system. This is pre-internet, folks. And actually experience life on your own little miniature computer, the joys and love of interacting with a Commodore 64 bulletin board. And here's the best part. There are some of these bulletin boards that still exist. They're all Telnet accessible. So you can even do it on Windows 7 if you want, or any operating system that has Telnet. You can go. These things are still out there. Actual Commodore 64 bulletin boards are still in operation. And you can use this article to let you build and create your own bulletin board experience. So an interesting, very obscure article. But again, you know, interesting stuff that people are doing. Alex also sent in, these are the last injection molds used to create the Atari Jaguar. So, what we're looking at in these pictures are the absolute last things used to create the last of the Atari Jaguars. Oddly enough, these things sold for $4,500. Is that crazy? The injection molds used to make them. So literally this guy, or people, could use those to create their own Atari Jaguar models. Now, these things aren't cheap. When you actually have to build an injection... Now, see, I didn't know this. Injection molding tooling can cost tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? So these machines are created on demand, and their whole job is to crap out shells for an Atari Jaguar. How about that, right? It also has the casings for, let's see, you can make the console itself, a cartridge, the buttons, and even the exterior of the Jaguar add-on CD drive. So you got quite a bonus there for $4,500. But how cool is that, right? I mean, would you ever use it? No, but hey, this is what, if I could have one, I don't think I'd pay $4,500. Let me rethink that. If I could have one that I could actually make, let's say it was the first Amiga 1000 computer, That was the injection molds. Maybe I would be interested in that. $4,500, I think the wife would say no. But yeah, you never know. You have to ask before you can be told no, right? Or beg forgiveness. Anyway, interesting story all the same. Alex also sent us in one of the sadder stories. Yeah, I know. You're thinking I'm going to talk about a child dying or, you know, somebody's dog getting ran over by a car. But no, in this story, so this is over in China, and apparently there's some pretty heavy restrictions on gambling machines. Now, gambling machines come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. When you think gambling machines, you're thinking of like slot machines. Well, they've got arcade games, which are really considered gambling machines. So they rounded up 1,000 illegal gambling machines. Apparently, these things are taxed or something. So you can't own them unless you're paying the Chinese government to allow you to use them. Something like that. I've got some Chinese listeners, so maybe they can set me hip on this. But apparently, they rounded up 1,000 of them, poured gasoline all over them, and torched them all, and just let them sit there and burn. Is that crazy? And there are high-resolution pictures for you to look at, if you can stomach it. I recommend if you do have small children, you excuse them from the room before you take a look at these things being burned alive. Diedrich Limper sends in, this is fantastic. Now, this is something I can get behind. I don't know how I'm going to fund all these Kickstarter projects that I'm volunteering money for. Come the middle of next month, I'm going to be out a lot of cash. This one's getting close. I better actually back this right now. Hopefully, it's 3 days to go, so I guess I better get this show out in the next 3 days if I'm going to make this work for these guys. Maybe I'll do a tweet in the meantime, because I want you guys to support this. Project Gianna. Remember the Great Gianna Sisters? It was the game that Nintendo sued them for, because essentially it was almost a 100% clone of Super Mario Brothers. That worked itself out, and now Gianna Sisters is back. Now, you may have seen it recently on the Android platform. You've probably seen it available, if you're lucky. I managed to pick one up finally. It's hard to get. It's rare. If you see it, grab it. Gianna Sisters also came out for the DS back in 2009. Good luck finding that. I found one, and it's one of my prized DS collectibles. But Nintendo let that go through, and they let it on their own system. Can you believe that? So now they're trying to get a brand new next generation version going of the Great Gianna Sisters. Now you got to check out some of the concept art and what they're doing with this. It looks fantastic. So I need to make sure that I keep this window open so that I can put myself down. Let's see, what's the pledges here? Let's see, for $10 or more, DRM free digital copy of the finished game for PC. Let's see, do we have some, is this going to be for the Android or no? Let me take a look here. Give me a second. It's a good read too, by the way. They poke a little bit of fun at modern game development too. Looks like this is going to be a PC only game. Well, that's okay. I can get behind that. So I will pledge my $10. Let's see, $15 gets you 3 alternate costumes. I could care less about costumes, blah, blah, blah. All right, I'm going to pledge my $10 right now. In fact, while I'm on the air, I will pledge. I will give $10 to Project Gianna right here. Right there. Excellent. All right, $10, it's worth it. It's worth it. I am now an official backer. Great, so I'm going to tweet this actually. Crap, I closed the window. See, I told you I wasn't going to close the window. I closed the window. I am going to make sure that I tweet this and make sure I get this out to everybody before the show goes out, because I want people to be able to support this. Good stuff. Let's see, what else do I have here? This is good. I got this from a couple of different sources. Various sources sent in. Somebody is actually trying to make Super Mario Brothers, right? The NES classic, the arcade classic, side-scrolling platformer. Get this, on the Atari 2600. That's a tall order, okay? But he's done it. He's released the first level, and it's downloadable. You can download it and play it in your 2600 emulator. If you've got a Harmony cartridge, you can put it on there and play it on real hardware. you got to check out the video to this. You've got to see it. I am stunned that somebody can milk that much out of an Atari 2600. Unbelievable. So check that out. There, we'll have a video for you, as well as show you where to get the game itself. Last but not least, actually it is least because this is the last one. Last and least is another Kickstarter. We got a lot of Kickstarters this month. We got to spread the word any way we can. This has 19 days to go, so I'm not worried about this one not making its goal. This one, maybe you've heard of Pinball Arcade. We've reviewed it on the show. I've talked about it on my various sites. I'm a big fan of both Pinball Arcade and Zen Pinball. I have no great allegiance to either one or the other, so there's no war zone going on here for me. Pinball Arcade does real pinball tables. Zen Pinball does slightly more fanciful tables. So there's room for both pinballs in my marketplace. So as you know, pinballs, especially the heavy IP pinballs, like Star Wars, Star Trek, Back to the Future, Adam's Family, a lot of these are cost prohibitive to make. Not because of the development and the programming and the scanning and all that sort of thing. And if you actually look over this Kickstarter page, they'll give you this whole thing in detail. So I know what you're saying. It's like, well, wait a minute. Pinball Arcade gives me the software and then I buy the table. So why would I fund a Kickstarter for one? That doesn't make sense because I'm going to buy the table when it comes out. Here's why. Table costs, there's a certain dollar amount fixed with table costs. And they know from a business perspective how many copies they can sell and what it's going to be a return on their investment of time and money. Unfortunately, a lot of the great pinball machines of our day have heavy, heavy IP and copyrights around them. Things like Indiana Jones and Star Wars, Star Trek, you name it, those all come with a very high price tag to license, right? So if they're going to make one of those, they not only have to buy the pinball machine, do all the scanning, do all the 3D restoration and all that stuff when they build the thing for the software, they got to pay licensing. And believe me, when you take a license like Star Trek or Star Wars or something like that, you're not going to get a loving handout from LucasArts or from Paramount. They're going to want some bank. So the goal of this Kickstarter is to fund Star Trek The Next Generation table for Pinball Arcade. Now, they're only looking for $45,000. That's going to pay for, I can't even imagine what Paramount's asking, and I don't think it says it in here. But, yeah. I mean, first of all, we all know, anybody who's big into pinball knows that Star Trek The Next Generation is one of the huge favored tables from Williams, okay? It's a fantastic table. It's a great pinball experience overall. Unfortunately, you're not going to get Paramount to release that without some cash in hand. So that's what they're doing. Now, they do have a video for you to watch. Now, I've passed this around before, but it tells you the entire process of what they have to do to make one of these tables electronic in a digital format. So there's a lot of cash. There is a lot of cash that needs to be put out for this. So that's why there's a Kickstarter project for this to help them fund it. Now, if we can make this happen, we can get some of those other crazy ones like Terminator, the Star Wars. I think we can actually get these funded if we show that we're willing to pay for it. So I've already contributed to the Kickstarter project. I urge anybody who's into Pinball Arcade, who's into Star Trek The Next Generation pinball, or who just wants to support a good Kickstarter project, you got some extra cash kicking around, you want to help support them, these are the sorts of Kickstarters that I want to support and to have the folks that I'm talking to support. So please check that out. See if that's something you're interested in. And with that, I am going to wrap up this month's Bits and Bytes. Remember, this is all news sent in by you guys, sometimes by us, but mostly by you guys. So send us an email, bitsandbytes@retrogamingradio.com. Tell us your favorite news stories, and maybe you'll hear it right here on Retro Gaming Radio. We'll see you next month. If you owned a 16-bit computer in the late 80s, you probably know all about a little publishing house called Psygnosis. With their owl and unusual-looking graphics, they really stood out in a time period where there were so many game publishers and developers. Psygnosis was synonymous with quality. You knew when you bought a Psygnosis game, it was going to look incredible, it was going to be an incredible game, and the chances were likely you were going to get something really cool inside the unbelievable artwork-laden box. That is, shirts and posters. Absolutely fantastic. Psygnosis was a symbol of quality. It was sort of like Imagic on the Atari 2600. You knew, sight unseen, that if you bought a product that featured that owl on the cover, that you were going to get a quality piece of software. A lot of people know Psygnosis from Shadow of the Beast, which is definitely the first of the large success stories of Psygnosis. But what a lot of other people know Psygnosis for is a little game you might have heard of called Lemmings, which has been another one of those games that has been ritually brutalized over the years. In fact, even as recently on the Nintendo DS, the great David Crane of Pitfall fame, we talk about David Crane a lot, he took the Lemmings formula and applied it to what would probably have otherwise been a horrible movie pack-in type title called March of the Penguins. However, thanks to it being a Lemmings clone, it actually turned out to be a great game. So Psygnosis has very, very deep roots. And oddly enough, Psygnosis has very deep roots in current modern gaming as well. The reason we're talking about Psygnosis today, of course, is that Psygnosis became Sony Liverpool when Sony purchased them and, of course, restructured them into a PlayStation gaming house. At that point in time, let's be honest, much like Atari is only Atari in name today, Psygnosis really wasn't Psygnosis once Sony bought them up. But they have a very rich history. And we are going to look at that rich history because, as of this month, Sony has closed the Sony Liverpool offices. And so, effectively speaking, Psygnosis, in whatever format it ended up being in, is officially gone. So we are going to mourn the loss of Psygnosis by telling their story. And I will share stories of my personal experience with Psygnosis products. Our story of Psygnosis starts in 1985 when the group was formed by Ian Hetherington and David Lawson. They formed Psygnosis from the ashes of a short-lived software company named Imagine Software, which folded just a year before. Imagine Software didn't have a long run. It ran about 18 months. And these two were, one of them, Ian was the financial head of Imagine Software, and David Lawson was one of the main talents. So they rose back and formed Psygnosis. The first game that Psygnosis put together was a game called Braticus, which was a fusion between a couple of unfinished projects that existed back at Imagine Software. But Psygnosis really took off in 1986 when they released their first game, Deep Space, which started the whole trend of Psygnosis's look and feel. It started off with the box art that had the unusual graphics, the hard-edged logos. The game was relatively hard and complicated, and Psygnosis would quickly gain a reputation for producing beautiful games that might simply have had just too hard a gameplay for the average gamer. Psygnosis was really just a publisher. But early on, they had their own full-time artists. Now, this was incredible. At one point in time, they had 10 different artists on staff. And the reason they did this is to provide their game developers and their third-party content providers with high-quality, consistent art. Now, this was actually very brilliant because Psygnosis became a brand, not just a publisher. And to have these artists in studio ready to provide these brilliant developers that don't necessarily have great visual acuity skills was a brilliant move on Psygnosis' part. The original artists of Psygnosis were Garvin Corbett, Jeff Bramfitt, Colin Rushby, and Jim Bowers, and later on, Neil Thompson joined the group. Now, there's a name missing from the list that many of you Psygnosis fans may know. and that is Roger Dean. Now, Roger Dean was not a full-time employee of Psygnosis, not from the notes that I've read. However, he did do contract work for them. Now, Roger Dean's actually a very famous artist. He made record covers back when there were records. He did all sorts of other artwork outside of it, but his artwork had a very definitive look to it. Now, Roger Dean was responsible for that famous Psygnosis logo and the owl, and he also was responsible for the cover art of many famous games, including the venerable Shadow of the Beast. In the next year, the game Barbarian came out. Now, this is not the two-player fighting game with the big Arnold Schwarzenegger guys with swords. This was a different game. But it was beautiful, it was gorgeous, and it had one of the first kind of gaming intros, which featured a giant muscular barbarian chopping a giant chain with his axe. And that was sort of the start of what would later on become a trademarked Psygnosis, not trademarked, but a signature. It'd be a signature of Psygnosis' games after that, which was, in fact, the intro. Right on its heels, Obliterator came out in 1988, and that actually contained one of the first more animated intros, which was also from Jim Bowers, which, interestingly enough, was working as a digital matte painter for the movie industry at this time. So he fell right in. And Obliterator featured an animated intro of the main character shooting at the camera. Then the intros went into full gear. The intros all started off as 2D hand-drawn sequences, but as time progressed, they moved into full-motion video, 3D rendered sequences created with Sculpt 4D on the Amiga, and in the end, they were actually bought Silicon Graphic workstations for the sole purpose of making these signature intros. Sometimes I would just boot a Psygnosis game up to watch the intro. They originally were doing Amiga and Atari ST games, but they ended up really sort of leaning towards the Amiga for the extra horsepower and abilities that the hardware offered them. 1989, of course, is when Psygnosis really got put on the map with Shadow of the Beast. They created what I would arguably call the killer app for the Amiga. So popular Shadow of the Beast was, such an amazing testament to the power of the Amiga computer, that it was regularly on demo in shops and stores all over Europe, as well as in the United States. When you wanted to show off the Amiga, Shadow of the Beast is what you showed off. 1991 was really the breakthrough moment for Psygnosis. While they produced a steady stream of very quality titles, DMA Design, who also did Blood Money, which is a very popular game, Menace and Blood Money, DMA Design created a little title called Lemmings, which of course was ported to every platform known to man. And I dare say that it was DMA and Reflections who did Shadow of the Beast. Those two companies probably did the most to get Sony's eye on Psygnosis for the buyout. They also created one of the most ambitious titles known at that point in time, called Microcosm. Now, Microcosm was not a critically acclaimed game. It was very much a incredible journey type game where you were flying through an organism, shooting down nasties that you would encounter. This was all done in a full motion video type tunnel. And again, the game was not heralded for its extreme gameplay ability, but it really was an amazing looking title, and it was a go-to demo title and a flagship product for both the CD32, the Amiga CD32, and the 3DO. The full motion video intro is still one of my absolute favorites on any title, to be honest with you. And the backing music was done by a fairly famous musician named Rick Wakeman. The entire product was just an amazing looking, there's an amazing look inside a potential idea, which really never came into fruition. But again, these are the sort of things that Psygnosis happened to be at the right place at the right time. Nickelodeon created a television program called Nick Arcade, and Psygnosis was brought in 1992 to create some of the games that the kids would play on the show. It's really in 1993 that Psygnosis sort of stopped being Psygnosis. Sony purchased them in 1993, and they were immediately put to work building games for the new PlayStation hardware. Surely you have heard of some of the games that they're responsible for, including the venerable Wipeout, G-Police, and Colony Wars. Many of those were ported to other platforms, including the PC. Psygnosis, though, was probably responsible for one of Sony's huge early successes. And this was not the first time this had happened. However, for Sony, this was a huge deal for them. Psygnosis created a cheap development kit. Now, development kits are usually very proprietary, and they're usually very expensive. But what Psygnosis was able to do was to create a very inexpensive personal computer-based PlayStation development kit. Sony liked it so much that they adopted it and used it as their main development system, which enabled more developers cheaper access to making PlayStation games, which is probably why PlayStation has so many titles out there. It was very much easily in the hands of so many. At that point in time, Psygnosis expanded. They got a new office in Stroud, England. And it turns out that they strategically placed that satellite office in that location because there were a huge outpour of MicroProse employees that were getting ready to leave the company. And Sony wanted to make sure that they had some place to go. And that would have been Psygnosis at that point in time. In 1999, technically speaking, Psygnosis became Sony Computer Entertainment Studio Liverpool. And the studio offices and everything else were renamed to remove the Psygnosis brand. From that point in time, really Psygnosis and Studio Liverpool turned out games such as Formula One and Wipeout. They made many of those series. But they were pretty much an exclusive Sony deal at that point in time, which is why the magic of Psygnosis didn't really live on. They were also responsible for a couple of other titles, but we're going to get to those in just a minute. These were offshoots of Psygnosis. In 2010, it looked like Studio Liverpool was in trouble. Many of their projects were canceled. And, of course, as most of you know, in 2012, Sony officially closed the studio. So there's your historical look, and I've managed to dig up some excellent little baubles of information for you with regards to Psygnosis and some of their, shall we say, contractors or development houses that worked with Psygnosis as publishers. You may have noticed a couple of titles came out that didn't say Psygnosis, but rather said some other different title. It was kind of hard to read because of the edged lettering that it used. From what I get, again, I probably am mispronouncing this, but it looks like Cyclaps is the name. And this is pretty interesting. Not a lot of history is available on Cyclaps, probably because Cyclaps was never really an external company. It was more of an internal division of Psygnosis. Now, Cyclaps started off as a Commodore 64 game that inevitably was merged with another game to become Bratakus. That's why we never saw Cyclaps as a game. But instead, though, it did become a sort of a division of Psygnosis. If you ever played the incredibly great Defender knockoff Anarchy, that is one game that was done with the Cyclaps logo and branding. It seemed kind of, and this is sort of speculation because nobody really knows for sure, that Cyclaps did more of the budget titles or more of the not so complicated action shooters. Anything that had a really big budget or really a lot of development time behind it, that all went to Psygnosis' name, but it seemed like some of the other titles snuck in under the Cyclaps name. They also came in smaller boxes and tended not to have a lot of pack-ins. Now, although I do remember having an Anarchy t-shirt, so they must have packed a t-shirt in with it at one time. Here's another little piece of information. Because of the gorgeousness and the beauty of the Amiga graphics that they were putting out at the time, their tagline for a good number of years was, "Seeing is believing." And anybody who has seen a Psygnosis title, especially at the time when it really meant something, you boot up a Psygnosis title now, it looks like a 16-bit video game title. But to look at it back then, when it was really, when they were cranking out poor upscales of Commodore 64 and Timex Sinclair games, or Spectrum games, and they were kind of upporting those to the Amiga, these really made a difference. This was night and day type graphics. So seeing is believing was their mantra. They had a lot of good internal development practice that you could simply never get away with today. If you listen to the stories of classic game developers like David Crane and Gary Kitchen and a lot of the other folks out there, Howard Scott Warshaw, a lot of them believed in the concept that the game is done when it's done. Psygnosis was the same way. They didn't put artificial deadlines, and they sat and worked on a game until it was ready. And all of the team agreed, from artist to developer to the sound effect guy, the game had to be ready before they put it out. I did mention that they used Sculpt 4D from the Amiga, but they also used, for a lot of their artwork, they used a little package you may remember, Deluxe Paint, which is, of course, one of the go-to products for the Amiga. It's why a lot of people bought Amigas. In terms of applications and electronic painting, Deluxe Paint was the killer app for the Amiga. There were several different development houses that were almost synonymous with Psygnosis, so much so that you figure that these guys were actually part of Psygnosis, but they really were just development houses that were using Psygnosis as publishers. Most of the biggest hits that Psygnosis put out were developed by these external units. These, of course, being Reflections, DMA Design, and Art and Magic, who, if the name Art and Magic sounds familiar, you might remember a little flying owl shooter by the name of Agony. Interestingly enough, one of the original founders, Ian Hetherington, that's a long mouthful of a name, Hetherington, said in a very rare 1997 interview, this guy was pretty much off the grid from what I understand. He didn't go on record much, and he was very much a, head down kind of guy. But he made a fairly profound statement in 1997 in a rare interview. He said, get this, foster the talent and yield the product, not buy the product. You can't buy brilliance. You can't buy product that's genius. You have to foster the talent. The talent will get you the product. You don't buy that outright. You hire the people that can make the magic. I thought that was kind of profound. DMA Design went on to do great things. Maybe you know them by their current name, Rockstar North, responsible, of course, for Grand Theft Auto, as well as a number of other high-profile titles. So DMA Design went on to do great things. With Psygnosis, though, DMA Design also, along with Lemmings, of course, also did two very highly acclaimed games, Walker, which featured your player with a split mouse keyboard, Ed 209, straight from RoboCop. I can't believe they didn't get sued for that. Very gory, lots of killing, violence, incredible intro, everything that you would hope to and expect from Psygnosis. And they did another title, which is an absolute amazing product if you've never gotten to play it, called Hired Guns. Now, Hired Guns was also available on the PC and some other platforms, but the Amiga version got the real love. And when I say love, this is, Hired Guns was a four-player split screen. Get this. Now, you got to figure out how old this is. Four-player split screen first-person sort of role-playing game, much like Eye of the Beholder or Dungeon Master or Bard's Tale. But the game featured tons of authentic weapons. That was one of the cool things about Hired Guns. You weren't buying fake weapons. You bought realistic weapons. I mean, all the weapons that you can imagine at the time were there. Shotguns, pistols, machine guns. Now get this. This is the cool part. Every single gun was sampled from its original source. So when you fired a 9mm gun, I don't think it was a Beretta, but you fired a 9mm gun, it was a sample of an actual 9mm. So this was an incredible piece of realism that they didn't have to do that. Most people aren't going to know the difference between an MP5 and an AK-47 when you're playing a video game. But these guys went the extra mile. Reflections did Shadow of the Beast, and I always thought that we would hear a lot more from Reflections, but they kind of stayed quiet and under the radar. For Psygnosis, they did Ballistics, the very interesting shooter Awesome, if you've ever played that, as well as one of my favorite little platformers, Brian the Lion, which the CD32 version is absolutely gorgeous. You got to play that. All nice AGA. Oddly enough, Reflections got bought up by Ubisoft. And now Ubisoft, working with Ubisoft, they're Ubisoft Reflections Incorporated or something now. They are responsible for the Driver series. So if you've played Driver, you are playing a Reflections game. Of course, it's arguable to say that Psygnosis created some of the most memorable games of the late 80s and of the 16-bit time frame. They had incredible box art. They had incredible intros. They had t-shirts and cloth things and pack-ins and gadgets and goodies thrown into the box. And they were a top-notch development company. They really signified quality. You don't have that anymore. It just does not exist. There was at one point in time when, say, Sony Electronics, right? When you bought a piece of Sony Electronics, you knew you were buying quality. You didn't have to go look at Consumer Reports. You didn't have to talk to your friends about it. This is, you know, pre-internet. Sony Electronics were top of the line. When you bought Sony, you were buying quality. Then all of a sudden, Sony, you know, turned into a consumer company, and they started putting out as much crap as everybody else. So Sony was no longer synonymous with quality. Psygnosis was something you could always buy without looking at the back of the box, without seeing it at a friend's house or a user group meeting first. You knew if that incredible looking box was sitting on the shelf, it was worth every penny you paid for it, and it was going to be absolutely top notch. One of the other interesting little things about Psygnosis is they were pioneers in disk copy protection on the Amiga as well. Many of their games simply were not copyable without special hardware, which nobody had. So Psygnosis did a really good job of protecting their developers' interests. And that's not saying the stuff didn't get cracked and released, but I'm saying the casual pirate, the one that is sharing with a couple of his buddies, that stuff went away because they were that good at it. They also had a reputation for producing incredibly fast load times because they used custom software, they used custom disk loaders, and all of their stuff was really, really fast. You didn't have to wait around that long to see those great intros. Psygnosis has always held a very special part of my heart in terms of the history of video games. In the Amiga days, they were it. You know, when Psygnosis put out a game, it was like Christmas, and you knew it was going to be the bomb. You knew it was going to be top quality. One of my favorite games that I still play today came out from them, and that's Nitro, which was made by Jamie Woodhouse, which is also the guy that created Quack for Team 17. So it's a fantastic game, and that's another one of those Psygnosis developer deals. And it was a fantastic title as well. So, Psygnosis, we miss you already. We're sorry. We were sorry to see you go the first time when Sony bought you. But we're even more sorry now to see that you guys are closing. Good luck with wherever you go. Huge amounts of talent in all of the Psygnosis and the spinoff groups and the developers that created some of the titles that took away so much of my Amiga playtime, Psygnosis. We wish you the best, and we hope Sony didn't screw you over too bad. We hope they paid you well. We hope they paid you well. Well, I hope you enjoyed that little look at Psygnosis. I might start doing that. I might start taking apart my favorite companies from the 80s. What I really like to do is get a hold of the boys, the Doherty brothers that put together Legacy of the Ancients. My God, can I get a hold of these guys by now? It's been like 15 years. They got to be on the grid somewhere. If anybody knows those guys that made Legacy of the Ancients and Questron, I'd love to interview them. I need to talk to them badly. So maybe we'll do more of this. This was fun. I really enjoyed it, and I hope you enjoyed it. Stay tuned for more great stuff right here on Retro Gaming Radio. This month we have a couple of reviews for you. The first one is Droid Tower. Now, Back in the old days, television was the best medium for advertising. And as kids, we were glued to the TV. In the early 80s, I'll tell you what, Saturday mornings were planted deeply in front of the TV, watching Looney Tunes, watching cartoons, watching Super Friends, you name it. From about 6 a.m. to 11 a.m. in the morning, that time block was all about cartoons and planting yourself in front of the TV. My parents would sleep in. I would get up, make myself a bowl of cereal, and plop down at 6 a.m. and watch television till 11. That's when the last show was on at like 10 o'clock, and that was Looney Tunes, the Looney Tunes show. And by 11, cartoons were over, right? Nowadays, you can watch cartoons 24/7. They got channels for that. But back then, that's how you got your feed of cartoons, Saturday morning. Well, Saturday morning was the best time to advertise. And believe me, the advertisings for games in the early 80s were simply amazing, right? It was like Christmas. Toys R Us had the greatest ads. They showed you all the best toys. They had catchy little jingles. I don't want to grow up. I'm a Toys R Us kid. Right? They still try to bring that back every now and then, but it doesn't really work right. They showed 2600 games. They always had the hottest stuff at Toys R Us back then, right? They were a commodity. Well, Toys R Us would have like a standard intro, right? I mean, like some goofy thing. It's like, here's what's this week at Toys R Us, blah, 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 blah. And they'd play the theme, the music bed in the background. And then at the end, then they would have a tail point, right? So they had a fixed beginning and a fixed end, but they would put whatever was new in the middle. And I remember seeing amazing things, Star Wars stuff, Atari 2600 I saw in there, more some of the other things, Big Track. I always remember seeing the Big Track, $60, losing my mind. I never owned one, but my rich friend did, of course. But Saturday mornings were about advertising. That's how you got the kids to hound their parents for something to watch, to buy, right? So, I remember this commercial coming on with Orson Welles. Had no clue who the guy was. All I know is he had the coolest voice, and this was the coolest damn game I'd ever seen. Orson Welles was horking this thing called Dark Tower. It was a board game with an electronic tower in the center. Now, many of you know what I'm talking about, and I'm sorry if I'm going over old ground here, but I've got to tell you about it so that I can tell you about the Android version of it. It had great, I mean, this was like the best commercial ever. And I'm assuming that Alex has it playing in the background right now, but you'll want to go back and appreciate it with its own audio, so you can actually get the full meal. This, to me, this was the pinnacle of want. And I never got one. I think this thing ran $70. That was after it had been around for a little while. You could not buy one unless you were rich, right? Essentially. Or you were an adult. And a lot of adults played Dark Tower, which is funny because then they wouldn't let their kids play with it. So, well, it's $80. You're not going to let your kids play with it. But every geeky kid I knew wanted one. Even the straight kids, you know, the kids who weren't into Dungeons and Dragons and all that crap, they wanted it. So what the hell was Dark Tower? What made Dark Tower so great? First of all, it's a complete unique piece of hardware. I've never seen anything like it. We talked about it briefly last month. And we've talked about tons of other types of board games and handheld games last month. I can honestly tell you I have never, ever seen before or since what Dark Tower was. The board itself, we'll separate it out. The board itself featured a standard game board with sort of clip-on plastic buildings, right? Remember the game of life where you would actually open up the board, but then you'd like stick in little ramps and bridges and little buildings? That's the same way Dark Tower was. And you would, it had four different kingdoms, and each kingdom had like three buildings in it. So you would start in your kingdom on your sanctuary, right? You could always go back to the sanctuary. Not anytime, but you could move yourself to that piece. And then you had a bazaar, a store, in other words, a crypt and ruins in your kingdom. Now the idea was every time it was your turn, you got to move one space around your kingdom. And you did this by the tower sat in the middle of the game board. You had three friends playing with you, up to three friends, right? So let's say you had four people playing. We'll keep this easy. So it was your turn. You would turn the tower to face you. The tower had like a microwave touchpad on it, like the ones that microwave use, and it had all sorts of different things you could do, right? For example, if you were going to move, you press the move button, and something may or may not happen. There, if you were going to go into the bazaar, let's say that you had moved up to the bazaar, and you were getting ready to enter the bazaar on that turn. So when you turn the dark tower, you push the bazaar button. If you were going to leave your kingdom and cross the frontier, there's a frontier space between each of the four game boards, game areas, you would hit the frontier button. If you were going to enter the tomb, you enter the tomb button. You get the idea. If you were going to go back to your sanctuary, there was a sanctuary button. You get the idea. There were also things like yes, no, and some other things that were on that control panel as well. So what was the idea of Dark Tower? Well, when it was your turn, you had to move around your kingdom. That you would turn the tower towards you, you'd hit the move button. Most of the time, nothing would happen, and you would move your player to the next square. But something could happen. An event could happen. It's hard for me to explain how the tower is built, but I'm going to do my best for those of you who've never seen it. It's even hard to tell on the commercial how it works because, you know, they're not showing you how it works. They're showing you what it is. The concept here is that if you were to take the top off the tower and look on the inside, there's literally a cylinder of colored gels, little tiny pictures, sort of like a light box effect, right? You know the movie posters that are kind of transparent? They put them in the light box so they light up behind them. There was a cylinder, sort of like a toilet paper roll or a paper roll. It was like that shape, but it had these gels on them. And the gels each had some different picture on them, such as gold, food, brigands, dragon, plague, lost. There were all sorts of different graphics, but there was like, I think, if I sat down and did the math, I think there were 12 of them total. And here's how it worked. The display window into the tower could show you one column of lights at a time, which was like three lights. There were light bulbs behind each one of the three that would light up to show you that gel. It looked great because it looked like a cartoon. Now, they weren't animated or anything. They were still, but it was truly beautiful to look at. The artwork was really cool and unusual. And the placements of the gels or the graphics, the placements of it were so that common events would happen in the same column. Right? So your player was actually a troop of people, a troop of warriors. Now here's the fun part. You had to keep track of everything on these little battleship-like cards. So you had these cards that said gold, food, and it had a couple of slots for you to put other things, right? But every time you moved, you had to take away one from your food column. And you did this by moving these little battleship pegs to denote how much food you had, how many warriors you had, right? So you start off with like 10 warriors. So you put that on your card. So you always could see at a glance what you had in your inventory, right? Scouts, healers, we're going to talk about those in a minute. But you had to keep track of all that. Now, it kept track of it in the game for you, too. But because you weren't always looking at the tower, it could be turned to somebody else. If you needed to see what you had to use these little paper cards, these cardboard cards with the little holes in them that you would keep track of. Sort of like cribbage, I guess, right? So anyway, so your band of warriors would move. Sometimes when you moved, you would encounter brigands. And these were creepy-looking monsters. The graphic is still kind of spooky-looking. And a certain number of brigands would show up. Let's say 10. Well, the cool part is when you hit move, right? And you were going to encounter brigands, it would go, da-da, da-da, and you would hear the spinning cylinder lining up the right graphics to show you. So it would spin to the brigands thing, and there was a little tiny two-digit LED readout above the graphics. So it would light up brigands, and it would say 12, right? And then it would change to a different gel and say warriors, and it would have 5, or 10 or whatever, let's say 10, and would keep flashing back and forth showing you how the battle was progressing. Every time you were, you know, you rolled, say, you know, you were successful in an attack, it would cut the number of brigands down in half. So let's say there were 20 of them, and you had 10, you won that round, they knocked them down to 10, and then you won the next round, it would knock them down to 5, you knock them down to 2, then down to 1, and then you'd win. Every time they won, they would take away one of your warriors. Pretty simple. You lose all your warriors, the game's over. You're dead. You're out, and the other people get to play. So you would move around the map. Your goal was to gather a key hidden in each kingdom. You couldn't approach the tower and attack the final goal without having each of the keys. So you start off walking around your kingdom, fighting brigands. Sometimes a dragon would pop up, wipe out half your men, steal your gold. And you had food. Every time you moved, you ate food. And the more people you had, the more food you would eat. So you had to constantly be finding a way to get more food and more men. So you'd have to work your way to the bazaar. You'd go into the bazaar, and they would tell you, you know, they would show you a picture of a warrior, and they'd say 6. So it would be 6 gold to buy a warrior, and then you tell them how many you wanted. Then you could skip on and go to food. Food is 1 apiece. I want 10. Blah, 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 blah. Now, you could haggle. And sometimes they drop a gold, 1 gold piece from the price, right? So warrior 6, and then you hit haggle. If you were successful, it would show warrior 5. So now you could buy it for 5. Most of the time, though, if you tried to haggle, the bazaar closed. You essentially lost your turn, and you didn't get to buy anything. If you're low on food, your guys start dying off. This is an amazingly complex game for 1982, folks, I'm telling you. So you would go through, and then you would cross the frontier into the next person's land. Now, all the time, the other players are trying to get the keys to those other kingdoms, too. There are all sorts of modifiers, right? Sometimes when you hit the move button, you get lost, which means you lose a move and you don't get to move. Sometimes a plague strikes you and you lose X number of men. Constant struggle. It's like I said, it's an amazingly deep game for what it looks like. So you can get a healer, which keeps the plague from hurting you. You can buy a scout. The scout will keep you from getting lost. And occasionally, after you defeat some brigands or something, you would get a Pegasus. Now, Pegasus lets you fly anywhere within the kingdom you want. Very handy for making an emergency trip back to the bazaar, right? You're out of food, you're going to die. So that's sort of the, in a nutshell, how Dark Tower worked. Now, you could imagine hundreds of little battleship pegs, cardboard cards, little cardboard trading cards that had the healer and the scout, little tiny keys you pushed into the cardboard cards to keep track of, the game board, all of the little plastic pieces you put on top of it, the tower itself, the flag that goes on top of the tower. This was a huge box with, I would say, at least 100 pieces in it. Damn easy to lose them. Damn easy to never be able to buy one of these things complete. These games go for a lot of money. Not complete. If you're lucky enough to find one that someone will sell you, Dark Tower is very hard to get and it's very expensive. So I actually found a Dark Tower. I own one. It's about 85% complete, and there are people that will sell you keys or pegs or cards to help you complete your set. It's almost like collecting trading cards. You almost have to haggle. I need a Pegasus. You need a key. I've got an extra gold key. Here's, you know, I need a Pegasus card. Let's swap. Or you'll just pay top dollar for them. So needless to say, if you want to relive your Dark Tower experience, it could cost you some money. So somebody decided, let's make an electronic version of Dark Tower. Now, this isn't the first one. In fact, a lot of the Java code that the guy used to make this was borrowed, legitimately, not patent trolled. These guys were patent trolls. If Milton Bradley were patent trolls, never mind. Okay, so Dark Towers are hard to get a hold of. So somebody created an electronic version, and these electronic versions have been passed around for a while. Most of them are fairly simplistic versions. The Android one simulates not only the tower, but it also simulates the game board. So literally, it's a pretty close to an original experience as you can get. Now, there's a couple of things wrong with it. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. But everything is pretty accurately simulated. So the control panel and the tower graphics and all of that stuff are simulated. Now, it's not nearly as cool as actually seeing a tower in person. I'm telling you, there's something magic about that tower. Anybody who's listening to me who has a dark tower that works still, you know what I'm talking about. It is simply not recreatable by computer graphics. There's a magic to it. But suffice to say, if you're going to have a computerized version of it, this is pretty close, right? So you're going to miss some of the charm, but you can still play it, and it's still fun. I blew an entire evening playing that damn game. I played it over and over and over again. Again, it uses graphics from the original board. It uses graphics from the original tower. And here's a really neat thing, too, is let's say that you've got a dark tower sitting in your closet, but the tower's broken. That happens. Tower's dead. It doesn't play anymore. You can literally take a little stand and put your Android phone right on that stand or your little tablet and put it in the middle of the game board, and you can play it, use it as if it were just the tower. So you can replace it, your tower, with a phone. See, you're looking for something to do with that old Droid 1 you had laying around? Now you know. You can use it as a replacement dark tower. There, you can play multiplayer with the Android app, which is very cool. So if you want to play four-player hot seat, you play, hand the phone to somebody else, they get to play. Hey, they hand it to the next person, they get to play, and so on. So it's just like, well, almost just like playing the original game. So what's wrong with it? Well, I already mentioned there's a facet of it that's I don't want to say cheapened, but there's a facet of it that's just not as cool when you're playing it on a little screen, or even a big screen. It wouldn't matter how big the screen is. When you're not actually turning that tower, when you hit the move button and all of a sudden you hear the motor inside turning the gel and you're wondering what's going to happen, there's an I don't know how to explain it. Those of you who've ever played Dark Tower, own a Dark Tower, you know what I'm talking about. Those things aren't really found here. But what can you do, right? The author can't do anything about that. Apparently, now, listen, I haven't played a real Dark Tower in 20 years. So, at least. So, I don't know just how accurate this game is. Now, those people who are rabid fanatics about the game, they claim there are still some inconsistencies with the product that makes it not 100% emulated, if you will. And I understand the need for purity. You know, with me and Dragon's Lair. Just like me and Dragon's Lair, there's somebody out there that demands an actual perfect version of Dark Tower, and I totally get it. For me, and 99% of the people out there, just like Digital Leisure tells me about Dragon's Lair, for 99% of the people out there, they're not going to know the difference between this and the real thing. Now, the neat thing is, this is free. No 99 cents, no $1.99, no in-app purchases to attack the tower. Totally free. Totally free to play. No hidden surprises. You can get it right now. Go to the Play Store and search for Droid Tower. Now, what's odd is the name of the product is Droid Tower. So you would think if you typed in Droid Tower, it would be the first thing on the list. But it's not. You have to pan through like three pages to find it. It looks like a green, little green icon tower. So there you go. That's how you can get it. So, do I recommend this? If you loved Dark Tower, you need to have this because you need to play Dark Tower again. You need to see how much of it you remember. You need to relive the cheeky sound effects and the game engine. It's something you need to do. If you saw Dark Tower like me and coveted it and never ended up getting your own, now you can play it. For those of you who have no clue what Dark Tower is, never heard of it, and what I told you doesn't even sound remotely interesting, you should probably stay away from it, even if it's free, because you probably won't get the draw to it. However, the game is pretty deep. And if you are a board game aficionado, one of those people that like to get together and play those big, giant felt map games, people who enjoy that turn-based kind of play, I think you'll find a very decent game in Dark Tower. Not just an Android app, not just a game, but the game of Dark Tower is actually pretty neat. Once you kind of get the hang of it, it starts getting easier, especially if you're playing by yourself, which you can do, by the way. You can play alone, which means you are against yourself and against the elements, the dragons, the brigands, the running out of food, which, by the way, is quite challenging on its own, let alone having three other people to play with. Suffice to say, though, I think just about any game player, anybody who's really into games, be it board games, electronic games, handheld games, I think you would enjoy the mechanics of the game, even though you can't appreciate what Dark Tower was. So do yourself a favor, grab the thing, and sit down and try it for a while. See what you think. I'd be curious at what people's feedback is regarding this title, whether you own it and you're now playing it again, or whether you never owned it and you always wanted it. Does this meet what you thought it would be? I'm curious. I'd like to know what people think. But absolutely recommended for just about anybody. Obviously, there's going to be some people that a 1982 board game on an Android phone just isn't going to do it for you. I get it. But I was very pleased, and a good friend of the show, Martin Parrott, pointed this out from the last show. So I am much in his debt for providing me with hours of entertainment yet again with Dark Tower. Hope you enjoyed the review. Stick around. We've got another review coming up, Deadly Dungeons. Stay tuned. There are very few genres of games like the first-person role-playing game. When I talk about that, of course, I'm talking about games like Dungeon Master, Eye of the Beholder, Bard's Tale. These were a very definitive genre of games that have a huge cult following, especially Dungeon Master. Now, many people think that Dungeon Master started on the Amiga. I know I did, until I was educated that it started off on the Atari ST and was ported to the Amiga. Now, Dungeon Master, like Bard's Tale and many of these other types of games like Eye of the Beholder, put you in a first-person perspective where you wander around a dungeon. Now, it's not like you're free roaming. It's sort of a fixed movement. If you remember the review of Legend of Grimrock, The Legend of Grimrock is the exact same style of game. You move using little arrow buttons on the screen, using your mouse. You move, you can rotate your view left and right, you can move forward, backwards, and you can, quote-unquote, strafe, if you will, walking left and walking right without actually turning first. So that's the basic movements. The dungeons are all, you know, fixed 3D type deal, even though you can kind of look up and down. It's still really kind of a fixed movement type deal. Those of you who are into this genre of gaming know exactly what I'm talking about. If you played Etrian Odyssey on the Nintendo DS, very similar. But let's talk about Deadly Dungeons. Now, Deadly Dungeons is the same style of game, first-person RPG. It's not so much a questing game. For those of you who played Etrian Odyssey, you know sort of Etrian Odyssey is find the stairs to the next level, get to the next level, wash, rinse, and repeat. Killing monsters along the way, picking up goodies, leveling up, grinding, hoping that you can be powerful enough to beat some huge thing that you run into. I call this explore and escape. Now, those of you who remember our Cardinal Quest review, same idea. You arrive on a level, you can't see all the level, you walk around, it maps it out for you until you can find the door to go to the next level. And that's what you do. That's what this game is about. The maps are huge. So, and they appear to be random. So you literally could walk 5 feet and find the door and not look anywhere else on the level and just simply jump to the next level, or it could be all the way on the other side of the map. You just don't know. So what are you doing while you're finding the door, right? Most of these sorts of games are very much turn-based. In other words, if you don't move and you just sit there, nothing moves around you. If there's a monster two squares in front of you and you stop moving, he stops moving. And you have a minute or you can sit there and take your time. Well, I'm going to ready this sword. I'm going to rig up this potion. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. Then you've got the games that are sort of like Cardinal Quest, where it's not real time. You've got like 10 seconds, but the game's going on without you. So you stop moving, and in 10 seconds, the dungeon will update. And then in another 10 seconds, the dungeon will update. So in 20 seconds, the guy that's two steps ahead of you will be on top of you, kicking your butt, whether you move or not. Deadly Dungeons is one step closer to real time than that. Literally, while it's not real time, it's really, really close. So if you try to play this game as if it were a non-real time game, you'll have your butt handed to you so many times it's not funny, because that's what I did. I treated the game like a Dungeon Master game where I could move, think, do some equipping, move some stuff around. No. Doesn't work that way. Literally, you probably have a second or two before the next piece of the game moves on without you. So if there are monsters in your line of sight, eventually they will get to you, and it will be fairly quick. One of the things you need to realize is that you can attack while you move. That will give you a huge upper hand in this game. If you stay still for any length of time, you're going to get dead. Now, this is a standard first-person role-playing game. Health, mana, XP, you kill monsters, you get XP, you reach so much XP, you level up, and when you level up, you get to add some more to your stats, and then you get to pick one of your skills, right? Skills could be weapon proficiencies with a sword, it could be shield proficiencies, or it could be a spell, like a fireball. So you wander around, you grind, you kill various monsters, hoping you don't get pinned in a corner. You heal, and you move on. You pick up treasure chests, gold, etc. Now, occasionally you run across this gnome-looking dude that will sell you stuff. Welcome. And, you can sell your crap, you can buy stuff. Now, I've only seen him at the entrance to the dungeon. Now, I'm assuming every couple of levels you're going to run into this guy. Otherwise, you may have to backtrack. Now, that would suck. I haven't gotten that far, and I've played a couple, 2-3 hours of this thing. I'm assuming we will run across a merchant gnome somewhere along the way. However, the game is also loaded with tons of potion types. So many, almost, that it's almost like a secondary magic system. Until you level up, you won't even get the opportunity to have a spell. So even if you're, magic user, you don't get a spell until you've leveled up the first time. And there's not a lot of class restrictions. You're a magic user, can't use a sword. No, none of that. You're really not a magic user. You pick a picture, and that's who you are. So don't look for a real heavy class-laden type stuff. Not in here. But the potions will do things. Of course, heal, mana, duh. Curing poison, curing blindness, haste, that sort of thing. Like I said, kind of like spells in a bottle. So again, you pick your own path as you level up, find the exit, move on. Let me tell you, those of you who are in love with this genre of game, I get it completely, because even though you're not doing anything, you're doing something, you're grinding is what you're doing. You're grinding, you're finding a door, you're grinding again, and you're finding the next door. There is a very addictive mechanic to that. And this game's hard. This game is not like Grimrock. Grimrock was great because it started you slow and there wasn't many monsters and you could kind of walk around and there were some puzzle elements. How do you get through this door? You got to hit the pressure plate, blah, blah, blah. There's not that in here. But this game's hard. If you do not keep on your toes, you will get slain. Now, at first, I thought the game only saved. Do yourself a favor. Explore the menus, okay? I did not do this at first. So I wandered around the maze, got dead. It sent me back to the last time I walked through a door, which was the beginning of the game. I'd go through the door. I'd fight. I think I was doing good. Boom, slain. Back to the door. So I started using the door as a save point, right? Because as soon as you go through the door, that becomes the last time you saved. Well, in my infinite wisdom, I did not check the menu to see that there's a save anytime you want. Now, a lot of people don't like that. A lot of people don't like the concept that you can save anytime. This game's hard, okay? You need to save frequently. Nothing to be ashamed of. Don't worry about that, oh, you know, if I save all the time, that's what's the skill on that? No, the skill is staying alive and not losing your progress. So do yourself a favor and save a lot. Now, unlike our other title this month, the Droid Tower, this game will set you back $1.99. And I would say that it's probably worth $1.99. Visually speaking, the game is aesthetically pleasing. The monsters are very well animated. They're very clean. The dungeon's good. The movement's nice. There are issues with the game. I've noticed nothing that kills the game, but like if you bring up a menu on your heads-up display, the game keeps going on around you. It's not like these other games where if you bring up a menu, the game pauses. No. That's another reason why it's hard. But if you bring up a menu and you're slain and it respawns you, the menu stays up. Kind of weird. There's a couple of times when that's okay, but there's other times when it's like obviously a glitch. But so far I haven't seen, it's never crashed, and it's one of those games that is never goofed up where it's like, oh crap, I can't do anything, I'm stuck here, I have to restart the game completely. None of that stuff. Pretty solid. You can tell that the guy loves the genre and he wanted to make his contribution to it. And it's not Legend of Grimrock. I'm not going to lie to you. Okay, Legend of Grimrock was a fantastic game. This is a decent game. This is, I would say, a good game. Especially if you like this genre, because there's not a lot of it out there. And especially if you like to be brutalized. Now, there are some people who love the pain. If you're an Etrian Odyssey fan, you know pain and suffering. Because that game is relentless. Now, unlike Etrian Odyssey and some of the other games, this game will auto-map for you. It's not something you have to turn on or purchase or buy. There's no in-app purchases. There's nothing weird in this game. So I can recommend it to you not being one of these freemium-type games. Obviously, you're paying $1.99 for it. It better not have any of that stuff. But you'd be amazed at games you buy that still make you buy more crap. So it does let you auto map. It's got good intuitive UI. It's rather substandard. I'm sorry, not substandard. It's different. It is not the same sort of UI if you're used to playing Diablo or Dungeon Master. The guy took his own UI under wing, but it's not bad. It just takes a little bit of getting used to. There's obviously room for improvement. There are many times when you're looking at an item and you're not sure it's better than the item you already have. You could use some auto-equipping, things like that. But, you know, minor details. For $1.99, what do you want? You know, I'm not one of those people that believe for $1.99 I should have a $50 RPG. Or even a $29.99 RPG, Square Enix. So, for $1.99, I've gotten more than my share of time out of it. It's fairly pick-up-and-play. Obviously, look at the dang menus so you don't make the same mistakes I made. But it's relatively solid, and I'm hoping that the guy will do some updates to it, fix a couple of the little niggles, and maybe add a little bit of questing in there. You know, I think we have some room for some questing in there. Maybe there's some questing in there that I haven't seen yet. I've played like three levels. I've gotten to the third level. But that was me getting used to the mechanics of the game. There are other little things in there too, right? Scattered throughout the dungeons, there'll be doors, and you'll get keys. Makes sense, right? You got a key, you open the door. Well, the problem is that the wall that the door's attached to, you can walk right around the wall to the other side of the door, so you don't really have to unlock it. There's no benefits to unlocking it. You're like going, I'm not sure I get that, but okay then. So there may be some little bit of unfinished pieces to it, but again, like I said, if you love the genre, there's not a lot of it out there. This is pretty well done. Believe me, in 15 minutes, the 15-minute refund period, in 15 minutes you'll know whether you like it or not. It's a safe bet. I don't remember if there was video on the Play Google Play page or not, but I think most people, if you're happy with that Dungeon Master esque type of a game. I think you'll be fine here. Again, people are freaked out about buying mobile games. For me, $1.99 is nothing. That's less than I pay for coffee in the morning, and the coffee's gone in 20 minutes, and I played this game for like 4 hours last night. So do the math, folks. Well, that's going to wrap up this review for Deadly Dungeons. Be sure to check out the other review, too, if you skipped around. Check out Droid Tower. For you Dark Tower fans, we finally get to play the game on our Android. We will be back next month with more reviews right here on Retro Gaming Radio. Well, folks, I guess that's going to wrap it up for the August 2012 episode of Retro Gaming Radio. I did want to, of course, mention our Twitter feed at Retro Gaming Radio. Without the O at the end, Retro Gaming Radio, no O. Retro Gaming Radio on Twitter. We also have a Google Plus page that you can follow us and circle us up, and we'll keep you informed of what's going on. And we, of course, have Alex J. Lopez's Shoutcast server, which is playing classic Retro Gaming Radio shows 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Go to shoutcast.com, search for Retro Gaming Radio. Or you can use your favorite podcast aggregator. Chance are likely we're probably listed in one of those directories as well. And you can pick up our Shoutcast address from there as well. So hope you enjoyed the show. Join us next month. We'll have another great, fun-filled, packed show for you. This is Shane R. Monroe with Retro Gaming Radio saying until next time, keep it retro.